Your homepage for horror is here. Fangoria.com is now live and brimming with the digital horror content that you crave. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. They're taking the time to aggregate the most important news in horror in one space to save you time and sanity. You'll also find long-form pieces, deep dives, and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Right now, all current subscribers to the magazine are automatically members of Fangoria.com. And as promised, the content in the new issues will forever be print only. So if you're not already a subscriber, check out the new Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use the promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now. Fangoria.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the Nick Taylor Horror Show podcast. Attention, horror filmmakers. Would you like free filmmaking advice from some of the latest and greatest horror directors? The Nick Taylor Horror Podcast is your go-to masterclass in horror filmmaking. Featuring interviews with guests like Joe Dante, Mick Garris, Roger Corman, Stuart Gordon, Tom Holland, and Mitzi Peroni, each episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show explores and deconstructs the successful strategies of horror directors while summarizing the key insights and resources that you can use in your own horror filmmaking journey. This includes their creative process, strategies for getting their first films off the ground, favorite books and tools, key life lessons, and much, much more. Download and subscribe to the Nick Taylor Horror Show today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere you listen, or visit nicktaylor.com for more information.
Okay, welcome to episode 170 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. Sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane. Hello, welcome.
Hey.
Ryan Turek.
Hello.
Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
And most of you already know who we are, but some of you may be newbies because on top of Blumhouse Productions producing this podcast, as they have for the last 170 episodes, we have a new partner.
Yeah.
Fangoria is also now presenting this, and we're now part of the Fangoria Podcast Network.
I love love affairs.
That was easy.
Yeah. This is awesome, guys.
So we all have a little history with Fango.
I feel reborn.
Right?
Yeah.
Totally reborn.
Yeah, we all have history with Fango. So.
Except, have you ever been, you got Prince Elric, I'm pointing at Elric.
I put him in one magazine.
I did a top 10 list for them of in the Haunted House one,
Haunted
and I did
house
an interview
issues.
With Brian Yuzna back before
right.
Society had come out again. I can't. We were actually making that at the time for FearNet, but I can't remember why.
No, we ended up. So it was that interview. That was a fun interview. Yeah. That was something that FearNet had purchased a pilot of.
Oh,
so we
right,
started
yeah.
shooting a pilot, but then after Jazz happened at FearNet, we ended up running it on Fango.
So Jazz happened at FearNet? That's a whole nother podcast.
Oh my God.
The main point
of this
is...
We've had a very wild journey in horror is what we're saying here, folks.
It doesn't really matter if it worked there. What matters is that I read it as a kid, probably a big part of what I got into horror, especially because, as I said before, it was like the only thing like that that made it to New Zealand. Comic book stores was Fangoria.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just some of the imagery, you know, that stayed with you. Even like art house stuff, like Gaspar Noé was the first, I think I've said that before, the first time I was aware of it was I Stand Alone before even, and it was just this one article, and I remember going, oh, I can't watch whatever that is, because that just sounds too crazy.
Yeah.
So I love that about the magazine.
My wife recently caught me bagging and boarding my old
Ooh.
Fangos.
Nerd. Do you have them all at this point? Because I know you were gunning for the complete collection.
I want the whole, yeah. Because I started collecting around, I think it was 98,
mm-hmm.
and then I kind of backtracked. No, sorry, I'm mistaken, 90. Mm. Issue 90, and then I picked up from there and then started collecting back issues. So there's a lot of stuff from 1 to 90 that I'm – not a lot that I'm missing, but definitely more gaps between like 1 through 15. Mm-hmm. So I'm slowly but surely getting through that. But one of the things that I wanted to do is just upkeep them, because out of everything that I have in my house and everything that I have in my collection, those are the things that mean the most to me, because one, they've gotten me, you know, through adolescence and those high school years. And the greatest story I ever tell is like I remember I skipped out on my homecoming. I ditched my date at my homecoming dance because
left her on the dance floor?
Yes.
To go read a Fangoria.
It had the Stand and the Crow coverage.
I'm picturing the slow pullback as the girl is standing by herself on the dance floor, dead still, and then we smash cut to Ryan just reading a Fango. I'm going to shoot this scenario. It's what I'm saying here now, Ryan.
It legit happened. I was like, you know what? I don't feel well. I have to go. And I left, and it was the most gratifying and freeing experience of my life. But
what's her name? Let's get her on Facebook. I want to tag the story.
Let's bring her in as a future guest.
God, no. But what I've been doing is just upkeeping the issues and going through them. And Ciara walked upstairs, and she's like, what are you doing? I was like, what I did through most of high school when I worked at the comic book store, which is just bagging and boarding. And you know what? It's a de-stress situation. It's super kind of nice and gratifying to just sit there and bag and board things. And she took a photo of me.
I feel that way about alphabetizing my DVDs.
Me too.
It's like zen for me. I'm like, I don't even have that many now, but I re-alphabetize them once a month.
Film posters for me. I like to open them, look at them again, know that I have it, fold it back up, put it in the closet.
Never see them again.
There's hundreds. I'm like, I don't even know what I own.
That's amazing.
It's so weird.
Should we go around? I mean, just for the new Fango listeners, you know, who we are. I mean, obviously they know who we are, but what we do and, you know, give a little backstory.
God, what do we do?
Possession.
Well, yeah.
Everyone go around.
One word that sums you up.
Well, that's my slugs.
Currently I'm the director of acquisitions and development at Fangoria. They're doing movies now, and so I'm kind of there. Before that, I was at Epic doing their Dread label, and before that, I was just writing on the web about horror movies for many, many years. Started Icons of Fright, was at Shakti Drop with Ryan, FearNet, Blumhouse when it was a website. We've been living and breathing this pretty much as far back as I can remember. Yeah.
So, well, how long have we been doing these podcasts on horror for
7 years now?
We were Killer POV, the three of us, Elric, Rebecca, and I, while Ryan was doing a show called The Bloodcast at Geek Nation. Mm-hmm. And then we joined forces. We had Ryan on pretty regularly on Killer POV, mainly for countdown episodes.
Yeah,
like
countdowns.
For the best of the year. And we just kind of fell into the groove of. This is a little different from our regular show, if this is your first time listening, where we kind of like to talk about what we've seen in the last week, whether it was in the theater, what came out on Blu-ray, etc. Just, you know, dig in for those gems like we often do. And then the second half, we'll usually have a guest on that one of us might know and have a connection to, which kind of makes it for a little bit more of a candid, straightforward conversation with somebody about their role in the genre in particular. I equate this, what we do, is kind of to the – we're video store clerks. In fact, I think we've all worked at video stores.
We all were. I only worked – in fairness, I was only at a video store for 3 months, and then I got a job as assistant manager at the local art house theater, so I went there instead. Mm-hmm. But – yeah. So not as long as you guys at the video store.
Yeah, I don't think that cuts it, to be honest.
Suck it.
After all this
suck
time.
Suck it. I still stocked my 20 copies of Time Bandits, you fuckers. So.
And just in case you guys like haven't picked up, there's a lot of friendly ribbing.
Yes, we know
kind
each other
of a family
well.
Family at this point.
Serious.
So any sort of kind of snarky remarks that are thrown at other co-hosts, it's all done out of love. I treat you guys like my brothers. Becca, you're my sister from another mister.
Yes. Yeah, Elric.
Before you label us misogynists. Just know that we actually like each other.
Yeah.
We respect Becca's opinion on everything.
What the fuck,
but there's a 6 month moratorium before
all right,
we watch
it. Dude. Elric, give us a little bit of background.
Where the fuck did you come from? Why are you here, Kane?
Where did I come from? Yeah, I'm kind of from New Zealand. I was born in New York.
You're a New Yorker.
No, you're
resume.
Not.
I made some, I've been studying film, you know, my whole life, pretty much, you know, since 20 or whatever. Made some indie films in New Zealand, super no budget stuff. Moved out here. It's only taking 20 years. Towards trying to make this first feature here, which is great. Hey. Everything's on track, at least.
We're making strides.
Yeah, almost. There you go. Yeah. Someday. But I'm also teaching film, run a little film school. And I started in the horror thing. I kind of like, it was funny. I always loved horror and just never, unlike you guys, where you're kind of in markets where you could start writing for Fango. I was nowhere near where that could happen. In fact, Ant Timpson's the closest connection I had back then. I didn't know he was part of any industry. He was just a guy who showed movies in New Zealand. But, you know, when I got out here, I was doing a weekly show called This Week In. And it was on things like poker and This Week In comedy. And I like I was the producer, and we just had to produce these shows for just This Week In whatever. And the one guy who worked there, Matt Raub was his name, he started one called This Week In Walking Dead. about 4 months before The Talking Dead actually bought it and took it over. So it was actually started here. And the cool thing about it is I'd show up to work and there'd be like these cool guests from the show I just heard. And I was like, holy shit, this is cool. And John Bernthal came in one time. He was super cool and it was super fun talking to him. And then I was like, hey guys, could I start my own show? And they're like, yeah. And I said, This Week in Horror. And so like straight away, but luckily, because I'd met Stacey Lang Wilson, a couple other people, that suddenly I had access to people. And so like I started with Lewis Jackson from Christmas Evil.
Yeah.
Then I knew I was away laughing, got Jack Hill, the famous Jack Hill on at some point. So it was like Bill Lustig, Larry Cohen. So it actually and it was a streaming video show, but I just don't think that stuff was really ready for that. And I wasn't on air. I never wanted to be, surprisingly now that I'm overly on the stuff. I didn't want to be seen or really heard. So I just like would write the questions and produce the show behind the scenes. But then when that wrapped, I thought, oh, I'll do it. And I led into Inside Horror, which was a couple season video. And that's where I met Becca just before that, brought her on to that one in some capacity, mm-hmm. even though she'd been doing, you know, way more stuff than I had been doing at that point. And we did Inside Horror kind of concurrently a little bit with the start of these podcasts, but it was mostly rapping by then.
Yeah.
And then I, to be perfectly honest, I never really knew what podcasts were until we started Killer Preview. To be honest, I didn't. I knew what video stuff was, and I never felt 100% comfortable doing the video thing. Mm. And so I think I've definitely come to life by being just able to be a free voice, because I didn't like being the lead person, like leading man. Like I much prefer you having to do that. But a straight guy, I like, and Brian, I like to be myself. So it wasn't until we were doing these that I realized, oh, cool, you can make fun of people, you can rip, you know, like you can just have more your actual natural personality. So then, and then I was doing this show. Man, yeah. That was long.
Yeah, so I started out my career working as a choreographer in Washington, D.C., and did that for a number of years. Thank you for the jazz hands, Kane.
Yeah.
And reached a point where I was like, this isn't what I want to do. I want to try something different. And sold everything I owned that I couldn't fit into my tiny little Honda CRX and drove to New York City with absolutely no clue what I was going to do. And took the grossest apartment you can possibly find on the upper East Side. I later discovered it's, if you listen to the song from The Velvet Underground, Waiting for My Man, where he goes to buy his heroin, that was my apartment. It was on that exact location.
Okay. History.
History, yeah. But anyway, so I was there and I was completely broke. But I had always been like a huge, huge horror fan. My undergrad degree was in film. And so I volunteered at the New York City Horror Film Festival that year, just because I couldn't go to afford to see any of the films, but I really wanted to see them all. And it was at Tribeca. And while I was there, they knew that I had film background and knew a lot about horror. And so they asked me if I wanted to Q&A a couple of the panels. And I said, sure. And I'd been in New York all of about 2 weeks at that time. And so I was up on stage Q&A-ing panels with Bill Lustig, and it was like a fucking dream come true for me. And afterwards, after one of them, where I had been talking with Mick Garris, was the guy who I was interviewing on stage, Mike Gingold approached me and asked if I might be interested in coming by the Fango office. And I said, yeah, that's crazy. And a week later, I was working as a research intern on the radio show. And then I got bumped up to an associate producer on the radio show. And then I got switched over to working with the magazine. And then I was working with the website. And then 13 years later, I was executive director of marketing. I ended up working a lot with Fango Television. And when Fango was trying to make films through our prior company, I was one of the leads on that, doing acquisitions and stuff like that. And so then after that happened, I went over to Blumhouse.com and was editor-in-chief working with Rob for a number of years. And then during that time, I went back and got a PhD entirely focused in horror.
She's the only doctor in the room.
Yes.
Well... I fancy myself.
Seriously, do you want to do this? Do you want to do
what the
this
lab
here?
Is about?
I love Becca's story because it's like saying if you do 15 years of really hard work and get a PhD, maybe you can be on a podcast. You guys it's out there true. Listening to this, it's some true. Dreams come true.
No, 15 years of working my way up through a company and getting a PhD simultaneously. I never went to school that I was not working full time.
You're never cheated. It's not like you also got pregnant and was having a kid.
I had two kids while doing so as well, and made two movies. And I like to stay busy. But then, so now I am full time. I teach many, many classes at USC, including horror classes, and then I moonlight at Studio School with Elric, and then I'm also still directing and producing.
And she made cookies for all of us.
And I make cookies.
So that's like a pretty well-rounded career.
So holiday episode.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Oh, and I have a second podcast on the Fangoria Network, Nightmare University. Give it a listen. It's fun.
I even got to be on it
once. Ryan.
I'll make it quick.
What do you do in this world?
You have a wild history, too.
Really quick. I moved out to L.A. in 99, started working at CreatureCorner.com, which was an affiliate of Chud.com. This was back in the early days of the internet. And then from there, kind of took a foothold in doing journalism and co-founded DreadCentral.com. Worked for Fangoria for a number of years, started up shocktillyoudrop.com with the Crave Online Network. After that, during that, did a little bit of writing for Rumorg. And then after that, got this glorious job at Blumhouse, where I am their VP of development and have co-produced a number of movies over here, like Happy Death Day and Ma, Halloween, the upcoming Halloween Kills, Fantasy Island, and so on. And there'll be a few more coming down the pipe. And
did you do Marked Ones?
No, that was before my time.
Because that one's really good.
I agree. I like
the I'm a big Marked Ones.
You're leaving out the Ryan Rotten.
You might know him that way.
And
I only say that because the first time I ever spoke to you, Rye, you called into the Fango radio show because it was Weekend of Horrors, and it was one of the first couple of years that I was doing associate production for the radio show. So I was running the phones behind the scene, and you were our rep out here for Weekend of Horrors, and you were calling into the show to give us like a rundown of everything
going on. I remember how nervous I was
person who answered your call before you went on the air with
Ryan
Rotten. And you introduced yourself to me on the phone as Ryan Rotten, and I remember going, who the fuck? Fine, patch you through.
Well, everybody had a moniker.
It's
Ryan
true.
Rotten.
I had Mistress Becca for all of about 5 months.
One. Did you have one?
No, was I was just Rob G. I was like, that's stupid.
I never got one.
Or Icons Rob G.
Icons Rob G.
That's close.
All right, I want people to at me and Rob give us some handles for us.
Rob doesn't need one.
No, I don't want one. You maybe. Although, you know what? That's so funny because speaking Weekend of Horrors, I remember one of the ones here in Burbank, Ryan, you were the one that broke the news on stage that Rob Zombie was going to do Halloween, which is 10, 12 years ago? Before, Scoops were on the internet.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ryan went on stage and said, first word here, Rob Zombie's going to do the new Halloween, and there was like, in the audience and everything.
Yeah.
And now you get to make your own Halloween. So get out of here. Crazy as that.
Fucking weird, right?
Very weird.
Anyways, I just want to give you a recap for the new listeners out there. And we hope you stick with us. And the vibe that we are going for is just you're kind of sitting in your home and we're there talking fun stuff about horror movies and maybe going a little bit deeper than the usual conversation about films that you might have with your friends and family. I like to think that we have really great conversations with filmmakers and other industry professionals that hopefully give you a little bit of insight and a look behind the curtain.
Did you listen to Julian Sands?
Not yet.
Oh my God. He is the most charming guy.
That was like, this is the backstory on Julian Sands.
Last week's episode.
All year long. It started at the beginning of the year when Julian Sands reached out to Jason Blum, and Jason looped me into the email, and he was like, the best man to talk to is Ryan, because he's the one that kind of oversees the projects that are coming through. And Julian was like, well, thank you so much for the intro, Ryan, nice to meet you. And I kind of like sidebarred the conversation to Jason. I was like, Jason, you just put me on with fucking Warlock.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is a big,
Warlock?
I don't know. But I was like, this is a big deal. It's fucking Julian Sands. And then Jason responds. He responds again to the email with Julian Sands. He goes, by the way, Julian, Ryan is your biggest fan ever. And I was like, oh no. But at the beginning of the year, I said, Julian, one of these days you're going to have to come on our podcast. And he was like, I'd be honored to. That'd be fantastic. So we were just waiting for the right time. And now that he's in one of the Hulu Into the Dark episodes for December, it just felt like the right time. And of course, it was the time that I had to travel.
You're traveling. Yeah. You know what's funny about that is like Elric and I, because he came in and Elric and I went to get him a water. And like Elric was saying, like, we have like directors in all the time, like people that, whatever. He's like, but when you grow up seeing
seeing somebody. Like, yeah, we were both weird. Smitten as soon as you walked in.
Oh, my God,
like,
yeah.
It's
no,
Warlock.
I was smitten,
dude,
too.
Yeah. Warlock.
No, mine was, like, the arachnophobia and just everything and gothic. Yeah. And, I mean, there are just so many movies that I just pictured.
But you also
from.
Expect him to be kind of stuffy or something. Like, there's just something about British actors in general, but he's also, like, a very specific type.
What are you saying about British actors?
That they can come off as stuffy. sorry, I had to explain that. I'll sign next time. But he was so passionate, like insanely passionate, that I was like, oh wow, that's cool.
That's
like,
cool.
And he worked with he worked with so many more directors than I think any of us really, like, I knew
realized,
some.
Yeah.
And even
yeah.
coming in, I'd forgotten Argento. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, oh yeah, that's right, Argento. Yes. It's just so cool.
I could just listen to him talk. That was the big thing. Like, I wanted great him voice. To leave my voicemail on my answering really machine. So just be like, Book is not here today. It was just so beautiful.
Well, I think weirder than that, when we finished, I got home and checked my email, and there's an email from Julian Sands saying, oh, it was great doing the show, and if you'd like to see that one movie, here's the screening, the link or whatever. And I was like, Julian, just seeing that name and your thing, it's like,
that's fun. Yeah. It's fun.
Life's weird. You know, being a fan of saying when you're a little kid and growing up to do this stuff. So just people listening, we are not insiders. We don't think of ourselves as elite. We happen to be lucky enough to be inside LA and get to do this, but we do it with passion.
That is the thing. It's like all of, you know, there was a lot of hard work to get us all where we are, but it's all. It's hard work, but we know that we are incredibly lucky. And what has never been diminished is our love of the genre.
Oh, God, no.
You know, and we speak very passionately about it. We get maybe overly excited about certain things, myself, Maximum Overdrive. But, you know, there are just a lot of things. There's a lot of keywords that trigger all of us that just, like, you know, our fanboy and fangirl just certainly come out. So we hope you stick with us. We've got today's episode, which is the best of 2019.
Yes.
Next week, we've got the best of the decade.
That is going to be hard. Yeah. I started thinking about it, and I was like, oh, I'll just pull one from every top 10 list I did.
I could literally do 19. I could have done a top 19.
Yeah, I could have done top 50, and I would have been cool, but having to narrow it down to 10, like, I feel like I'm hurting film's feelings.
Yeah, I have to get into my homework on that. But we have those two great episodes to carry you through the rest of the year. Next year, 2020, in January, we've already got a great lineup coming up.
Oh, yeah.
So, welcome.
It'll be a slightly different, for the new people, it'll be a different format. Usually we start with what we've seen and then move to the interview, unlike these next two, but these next two are super fun. It's a great way to remember, kind of like, especially these top of the year. I always think we're all so eclectic in our interest. I feel like the last 5 years, there's been amazing movies each year.
Yeah.
And so I think looking back at a decade, it's like, oh my God, we've been doing this for almost a decade.
Almost a decade.
So it
is
a weird thing to be, like, we've been making these lists for a decade. So it's going to be an interesting
one. There are legit titles that I was about to put on the list, and I went, wait, that was 2008.
Yeah, I had a few of those as well.
Oh, man.
Yeah, speaking of eclectic titles, Rye, you missed that I watched Night Beast last week with my entire freaking family.
I still haven't seen it, though.
You need to catch up so that we can see.
Yeah. I was going to say the things that I just want to briefly, because I haven't been on the last episode, but I did catch up to The Prey.
Yes.
Oh, that is that
and I do have the 83.
Okay, because I just got the new Blumhouse film, The Prey, as well.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
That one has less banjo, I think.
Yeah. Less banjo?
Or less nature photography.
Well, technically, so it came out in 83, and Arrow just did a great Blu-ray. But
great Blu-ray.
That's what's interesting is it's actually shot in 79. So this movie is kind of a lot like Just Before Dawn, where it's like, they're doing stuff that gets copied later.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh.
And it's probably why I took to the film so quickly, because it was like all the ingredients that I love in a movie from this era. You know, it's just kids going out camping, you know, not a care in the world, and then something just starts picking them off. And, you know, it's cool. It's a cool, atmospheric, fun flick. And, you know, the funny thing is I almost said a snarky tweet where I watched a trailer on the Arrow Blu-ray, and the trailer literally shows every single major kill. Mm. So for all of you suckers out there that say trailers ruin movies today, they've always ruined them.
Oh, that was like the thing in exploitation, especially grindhouse films. Yeah. You would show everything major. That's not.
But it was
quarantine didn't start that.
Nah,
children.
Nah. But I do. But I do like. I did like The Prey, and I also watched Unmasked Part 25.
Okay, let's just step for a second. That's the most excitement. The Unmasked 25. Is there? You all of us were just like, oh wow,
my God, how was it? This has existed on VHS for decades. How was it?
It's such a quirky, weird, charming little movie about basically it's like it's Jason Voorhees, and he's living in England, and he knows that movies are made about him, but he's kind of going through this existential crisis about what his lot in life is. He's got an abusive dad that lives in a dilapidated building, and then he meets this blind woman and they fall in love. And it's incredibly sweet, because there's a moment where he's like, I wear this mask because my face is so mangled. She's like, take it off. I'll feel your face. And then, but she's still okay with it. And then they go out shopping, and it's so cute because he's going clothes shopping. He's got the fucking hockey mask on. And then from off camera, his girlfriend comes in and she's wearing the same mask. And he goes, what are you doing? And she's like, well, I wanted you to feel normal. Like we can be together and we can go out in public both looking like this. And he's like, I don't know. And then you see them walking hand in hand, like, through the city streets. It's incredibly fun.
I love this concept.
It's a nice little, it's a fun little discovery that,
his name's Jackson.
Jackson,
not Jason.
Yeah. Jackson, yeah.
Just so you know, it's just a little off.
So. Yeah, yeah. and it's like a similar background.
Yeah.
You know, he was like, he drowned in a lake, his mom wasn't watching it.
Yeah. Da, da, da.
But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think this one's kind of a little gem.
Yeah.
I never even heard it.
As well?
Yeah. I got the Vinegar Syndrome disc as well. And I was just like, it's so quirky and bizarre.
It's very weird. I mean, it's got very distinct British humor.
Yeah, it's like a very British spoofing American films, American horror films, and yet they take it seriously. It's not like when we do a scary movie spoof where it's just goofy.
You know what? I'd say the great parallel is like, look at something like Student Bodies, which is very over the top, and the color's very occasionally purple and very, very outlandish. And this one tries a similar approach, but through a very different comedic filter.
Okay.
It's cool. It's definitely, I think it's worth a buy. I tweeted about it, and a couple folks said they picked it up, so I hope you guys liked it.
Cool. Does anyone want to talk about any films before we dive into our list?
Yeah, I'll talk about this one because I watched it just as like a film that came out this year, thinking that it might be one I'd put on my list. It will not be making my list, but it's one that it was definitely still worth a mention. The Wind.
Emma Tammy's movie. Yeah.
Yeah,
I thought you would really like that one for some reason.
I did. It didn't make my list, but I really dug the setting. Just because it is so simplistic. It's just a man and a woman pioneer couple, and they're living out on the prairie. And one day, this other couple moves in like a half mile away, and at the same time, you kind of get this wind that approaches, and this idea of demons, of prairie demons, enters, and the woman starts seeing things, and you kind of go back and forth with her husband going, no, you're just going nuts. And the isolation and questioning if she is nuts versus no, there's really fucking something haunting her. Mm. And so it was a really cool, small film. Definitely enjoyed it. And it didn't make my list, but still one that I would recommend people check out.
It's
I
got was a spooky not a, quality.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot, but again, it didn't make my list either quite, but then there's a lot of good, I feel like around my 10 spot, there's like four films.
I have like five honorable mentions. So it was on there. It definitely was like an honorable mention of one that I was like, there's something really attractive and charming about this movie. And I was really impressed with just how much of the film is just one woman by herself in a cabin.
Yeah.
Because there's something happens within like the first 15 minutes that the husband's like, I got to go into town for supplies. I'll be back in 4 days. And then the bulk of the movie is just her by herself. But I was still captivated and into it. And it was definitely still really beautifully shot.
And there's some demon stuff in there. So it's not like it's just a person hanging out. It's not totally minimal. There's actually a few kind of scary horror beats to it, which is cool.
There's good beats.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I saw a new one that I wasn't sure. I watched it for this, but I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of horror-ish, but it was called Little Joe.
Oh, yeah.
Had a great trailer that a lot of people were sharing. Super atmospheric. And it's one of those films that like kind of nails that that kind of slow-moving dread tone, but never has a peak or valley. It just kind of has that one tone from start to end, but it definitely has a subtext, which isn't really even just subtext, of Invasion of the Body Snatchers to an element. It never goes all the way to that. But if you had told me that this was another part of that kind of, how we get a remake every decade, I'd go, yeah, sure, because it's really cool. So it's basically kind of poking at the pharmaceutical company, and it's these people growing these big red flowers, genetically engineered flowers that the pollen, when you inhale it, is going to make you feel good and make you feel happy. And so they think if you plant these, if we get this right, people are going to be happier. And this is a really great performance by, I'm going to look up her name, Emily Beecham. And I think she actually won Best Actress at Cannes in this film.
She did.
Ben Winshaw's in there too, which people have seen in a lot of film. But she's really good. She's kind of the driven scientist, but she also has a son, and she's like separated from her husband. And you know, she brings one of these plants home, and the son starts to kind of be on side with the plant more than her. And it starts getting weird as people start breathing it. But it plays a lot with kind of like the original Invasion. It plays with the idea of like, am I just imagining that everyone is kind of changing around this plant from paranoia, or is it actually happening? It's one of those ones that have had like a like slightly bigger last couple minutes. I probably would have been unforgettable, but it kind of just, you know, it kind of stays in that same spot, but it's really stylized. It almost is Wes Anderson stylized.
Remind me, how did you say this?
This one has just landed on streaming like on Friday. So it was on Amazon on Friday, looked great. But the fun part for nerds like Becca is...
Wait, you'll see why.
I think I already told
this
you.
This might turn into a compliment.
Yeah, it is a
compliment. I'm holding judgment. No, getting a little judgy.
It is a compliment. The one thing I kept recognizing, I kept watching this movie going, what is this music? It's so, I was literally feeling flashbacks in my body from this music they're using. And then as soon as I think I even texted Becca saying, this feels so much like a Maya Deren score. And I look it up.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And they literally had taken Maya Deren's 1930s and 40s film, Meshes of the Afternoon and stuff. They had just taken the soundtrack and used it for the movie.
Wow.
So it's a literal, and that was a movie that was a huge, for people who don't know, a huge influence on people like David Lynch. I mean, you watch that, watch Meshes of the Afternoon, then watch Lost Highway, and you're like, okay, I can see where almost the entire
everything
outline comes
is
from.
Meshes.
So it's, so if you're, and so it's kind of that he was a Japanese American composer.
Taiko drums. The majority of it was Taiko drums.
Which is kind of a little alarming and shocking. So it's cool that they're using this weird old score in this very modern looking sci-fi-ish movie.
That's very cool.
But I thought it was really cool. Like, to be honest, it's one of those movies that if I saw it 4 months ago, maybe it would have made my 9 or 10 spot, but it's just a little too fresh.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Little Joe.
British film. Jessica Hausner made it, and she had made a couple films before this one.
My film students loved this one. Mm. I haven't seen it yet, but they all were like, you have to see this.
It's very
stylish.
This
is like one of their faves of the year.
Yeah, that's cool.
I have one quick recommendation. This was on the festival circuit earlier this year, and I really wanted to look at it as a potential acquisition. Finally came out from New Zealand, a movie called Mega Time Squad. Have you heard of this already?
Oh, yeah, I've heard of this, yeah.
It's on Amazon Prime now, so you could watch it on Prime. And it's really, really quirky and fun and funny. It's not really 100%. It's not horror per se.
This looks wild. Yeah, I'm staring at dinosaurs.
But it looks like Turbo Kid or something from the poster.
It's got a Turbo Kid. Yeah. It's got like a Turbo Kid vibe to it. But it's written and directed by a guy named Tin Van Damon. And basically, this guy, John, who's kind of like a simpleton, works for... I don't know. I guess they're thugs. They're led by one of the guys from What We Do in the Shadows, the movie.
Which one is it?
I forget their names, but he's...
Reeves?
What's that?
Is it Reeves?
Oh, it's Johnny Bro.
There you go.
He's very funny. He's in Taika Waititi's first film, Eagle vs. Shark, and he's really funny.
Yeah, he's hilarious. So he's kind of like this thug guy, and he basically sends this guy John and one of his cronies to go rob a Chinese antique store because it's kind of a front for the triads. And in robbing the place and at the same time pissing off the triads, he also steals a cursed bracelet, which is actually a temporal dislocator, which gives him the ability to time travel back like a few minutes. And so basically, he meets an untimely end, goes back in time, and all of a sudden there's two of them. And then he's like, wait a minute, I could do this much easier if I just have a third one. And before you know it, there's like five of them. So there's a bunch of Johns and they nickname themselves the Mega Time Squad. They're like, wow, well, like I'm my own squad. And so it's pretty fun. It's like him just trying to like avoid the triads, get some money and run away with the girl. It's a lean 86 minutes, which I'm always a big fan of. I thought it was a lot of fun.
And it's on Amazon Prime right now.
Yep, on Amazon Prime.
Just added it to my list.
Mega Time Squad.
Before I forget, big thank you to, we have, obviously we've been doing this for a couple years. We have amazing listeners. You never know who's listening to the show. Nathan Ballingrud, who is a novelist who has mentioned on here before when I think Becca was reading
North American Lake Monsters.
And then we all started watching Wounds recently on Hulu, and he sent us all copies of these two books, which was super nice of him. And he's been listening, I think, from very early. So I believe that was the story, The Visible Filth, that they used for that film. So yes, just thanks for that. And if anyone wants to check those out, they're out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready? Ready?
I don't know. Do we have to call Fango and ask? Do we have to call Blumhouse? How does this work now? I don't know how to do the show.
We just got to do it. Let's jump right in.
So Ernie, are you ready? Has anyone told anyone about Ernie?
Ernie is our sound engineer.
He's a real guy. His name is Ernie. He listens to our ramblings every week. Sometimes he falls asleep while we ramble, which we don't blame him.
We don't blame him. No. Sometimes he watches baseball, and we see him like get excited. And Elric understands that too.
He talks sports with him a little. thank you, Ernie.
But sometimes you'll see Ernie with us at conventions. He gets to make an appearance. So yeah.
Thanks, man.
So, I guess before we get into our list, what did you guys think this year compared to the last few years? I feel like the last couple years have been especially strong. I felt like the last 2 years before this were some of the strongest I've been a horror fan in terms of just quality horror cinema. Mm-hmm. How did you guys feel this year?
I thought it was just another terrific year of diversity, both behind the camera and on the screen. I mean, you know, we went through a lot of pockets just as genre fans. You know, we went through the, you know, post-Scream era, J-horror era. I mean, I'm talking about over like maybe like the last two decades.
You're going way back.
No, just the last two decades, yeah. You know, and then we went through that kind of whole torture porn era. And what I relish now and what I've been relishing for the last couple of years is that now it's a celebration of multiple stories being told as opposed to Hollywood jumping on a specific bandwagon and just hitting key phrases of, okay, we need torture porn, we need another horror remake, we need this. Now these things exist in our world still, but I think now more than ever we're just getting so many diverse stories being told on a theatrical level, which is really exciting. And even on streaming, which is no longer has that stigma to it. Whenever you heard like direct-to-video, there was always people turning their nose up at, you know, how a film was being presented on those platforms. But now it's like the streaming is where you go discover stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, hunt for it.
That was my biggest revelation when I was looking over my list is in previous years, it's a lot of big budget theatrical movies or it's smaller movies that strive to be theatrical. They do limited theatrical like It Follows or The Witch. And looking over my list this year, the majority of them did not do theatrical. They went straight to streaming in some capacity, be it Shudder or Netflix or Hulu or wherever. But there were only a couple films on my list that I saw in theaters or that even had theatrical releases. And so you definitely can kind of see the turning of the tide in that. Mm.
Well, yeah. I think how long Shudder been around? Is it 3 years?
3 years now.
So I think you do see a big difference in quality in world cinema coming through what they release, which I think some of our favorite discoveries of last year, I remember were some that just popped up at the end.
Yeah, Satan's Slaves and the Terrified.
Yeah, there were at least three or four foreign films that I got from Shudder on my list last year. For me, it's the same as last year. I think there's a good diverse batch of stuff, and I am the type of fan that I like to be general audience fan. I do like the franchise stuff. I do like the small independent stuff. I like a little bit of everything. Yeah. But I feel the same way about my list this year as I did last, which is basically I think my top five are super strong movies, like that it's really hard to decipher which one I'd like better than the other. Whereas 6 to 10, I like them all, but it's almost like they're not really part of the rank. Like I don't love them as much as my top five.
Right.
I just think there was a lot of really good movies, horror movies out there that, you know, I was like, all right, this one I want to mention because of this. So that's kind of how I went about picking them is I think my latter five are more ones that I really liked a lot, whereas my top five are ones I loved.
Yeah. I always have to preface my top 10 with this, which is there are no Blumhouse films included on my list. And everything that's reflected in my list really comes from a place of rewatchability and less what I consider the best, but more of my favorites.
That's it exactly.
The ones that I really, really want to revisit, time and time again, and just kind of stuck with me. And the ones that I kind of reach to when people are like, oh, what should I check out? Well, that's pretty good. So that's what my list consists of.
Well, and objective lists tend to be horseshit, right? Like there is just, I mean, it's impossible. Like we're a bunch of personalities. You're going to go through what you like. Sometimes it's hard because there'll be something that's so universally praised, it's hard to leave off. But really, you have to love it.
Yeah.
And I think we're all going for our taste. Like the kind of movies we want to make or think about, sometimes you're just drawn to these weird weird films. I definitely think some of us will tick that box. But yep. There's also some weirdness. Like some of us, we've had different rules on here before. Like if you start saying at a festival, we try not to include something if it hasn't
right.
actually
yeah.
come out. We
if
can
it hasn't got an official release.
Which is always
year.
Dicey because like I put Tigers Are Not Afraid was like in my top three last year, but it had not had a formal release. It had played every festival in the U.S., yeah. but it had not had a formal release. So I did not put that on my list again this year because it was on there last year.
And I've got a couple like including that one where it's like – because I saw it so long ago, like literally saw it almost 2 years ago, yeah. it's like, oh, I already did that in my mind. So sometimes that's a bit of a bummer because
it's on my list because I play by the rules.
Well, that's good.
Oh, God. There's
take that, suckers.
There
like, that's a spoiler.
Is.
Mild spoiler. Yeah.
And I've included television in here as well.
Wait,
what?
You can never include TV in this list.
I'm including
I tried
TV
that.
On this list.
Okay, let me
I'm
just point out.
Call me out on
I
it.
Included... Inside Number 9 2 years ago, and you guys never let me live that down. And then last year, Elric put Twin Peaks on his list, and you guys freaked out.
I didn't just put it on my list. It was my number one.
And y'all freaked out.
An episode of it. Not.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
I think you'll all agree with me. When I mention these two titles, you're going to say, oh, my gosh, Ryan, what a revelation. I should have included television on my list.
Listen, we can't
Hulu
control
into
you.
Into the Dark, episode 3. No, you can't. Hulu Into Dark can't be on yours either, right?
No.
Yeah,
no, Hulu Into the Dark.
Wow, all right.
There we go. We've laid down the ground.
Okay.
So we want to go to number 10?
Number 10. Should I kick us off and we'll
kick
just go
off.
Left to right?
Kick
all
us
right.
off.
So my number 10 was In the Tall Grass, which is Vincenzo Natali's new movie on Netflix based on the Joe Hill, Stephen King novel?
Yep.
Novelette?
Mm-hmm. Novella.
This just dropped, I think, around October, around mm-hmm. Halloween time. Mm-hmm. And I find myself thinking about it quite a lot. I just thought stylistically it's the perfect complement to his first movie, Cube, which is a very simple story about, you know, I think it's actually brilliant every time I revisit Cube how he pulls off one room as this grand sci-fi idea and concept. And this is the same thing. It's a group of people that are lost within a field. Brother and sister here, a little kid crying for help. They run in there. They separate. And then next thing you know, I love this scene, the way they illustrate it is they're like, I can hear you, but I can't see you. And they mm-hmm. jump up and they see that they're, I don't know, 20, 30 feet away, and they're like, okay, jump up again so I can see. They jump up again, and now they're much further apart.
Yeah.
And I just remember being like, whoa, that's a very cool, it's scary. When you could put yourself in the position of that character and wonder, like, I don't know how I'd react to that. That's scary. So I really loved it. And then, you know, Patrick Wilson comes into the picture, and he's always great. This is one of those, it's just a tight thriller. With a great little concept, and I'm unfamiliar with the original story, but I've heard that Vincenzo expanded upon it for the movie, which is fine with me. I just thought it was really solid. So that is my number 10.
Yeah, that was my runner up. It's not on my list, but it's definitely one that I thought about, and I thought it was a remarkable movie for, you know, Vincenzo, who had done Cube and Splice and then worked on a lot of Brian Fuller's Hannibal NBC series.
Mm-hmm.
It was just great to see him get back in the director's chair for a feature and do something that was super abstract and weird, but also... very familiar kind of thriller setup. Maybe Rob, you agree with me or not, but I feel like the last 15 minutes or so kind of lost me just a little bit as Vincenzo kind of went in wild territory. Maybe that's where he like kind of spun off from the novella, but it's really cool. It's worth looking at.
I think so. And there's a lot of interesting things done camera wise with the grass, which is always kind of fun. Like when you make the trap setting kind of a character in its own right. Interesting little tidbit that's not common knowledge, but I recently met up with Anthony Scott Burns, who's a director, and he's also a musician known as Pilot Priest.
Mm.
Awesome guy. He shot a lot of Second Unit on this, so he's telling me a little bit about getting some of that fun grass footage.
That's cool.
Yeah, super cool. So shout out to him.
Nice.
Okay, so my number – I still haven't seen that one. It's one of the few I haven't seen, even though you guys keep telling me. I saved my number 10 – I've got to say, number 10 was vying for like 5-6 films.
Yeah.
I save it for my I Like Where You're Headed – kid. I'm going to save that for my number 10 spot. I got to say, and shout out to the Fangoria cover, I'm going to put Joe Bigas in my number 10 spot with Bliss. I also saw VFW, and I think that showed I just think it's such an interesting year for him. And for me, having seen his earlier films, to me, Bliss was, especially where it kind of lands the last 20 minutes, it was just like a fun, refreshing, super raw film about a L.A. artist. They fought really hard to shoot it on 16mm film. She's an L.A. painter. She's kind of got blocked. She becomes a vampire. She's hard partying with these other – or is it a vampire? Yeah, I mean, essentially. And then slowly it just kind of unfolds in the last act of this film where it starts to feel like an Abel Ferreira film. And it just felt like a real level up for me as a filmmaker of what he was doing. And then when I saw VFW, even though that's technically not going to be till next year, when I start right on the heels, I was like, all right, you did these two things in this year. I like this direction. VFW is a real blast.
I like where you're going. I get it. You know what I mean? Great. Cool.
I like where you're going. But I did. I enjoyed it. I wish I could have seen it again before doing this. I saw it like at midnight, quite early in its festival run, and it played really well at midnight. So I don't know. I dig it, and I'm glad to see like him just sticking with it. It's kind of they don't really bend. They just get their movies
made the way,
and I find that very inspiring. Even though they're a lot younger,
yeah.
Curse them for that. But
and I think. So this one's on VOD and it just came out on disc, and I want to say Shudder. It should be on Shudder soon too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and a great central performance. She's really great because she is doing what would usually be a total jerk asshole guy role. They just basically cast her as, and she's so it seems like she's playing Joe.
Mm,
and
yes.
it really works because she is deeply unlikable for most of the film, and yet you keep going with it. And by the end, you just get to see some totally bonkers, phantasmagoric goo. It's good fun.
Phantasmagoric.
Yeah, like
goo.
Yeah, Dora Madison is the lead.
Yeah. She's from Friday Night Lights.
She's on Friday Night Lights, and I met her briefly on the last season of Dexter.
Oh.
She was Masuka's daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, so that's my number 10.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Yeah. All right.
My number 10 is Daniel Isn't Real,
nice.
Which is a latecomer to 2019.
Yeah.
This one is about a young man who basically imprisons his imaginary friend at a very young age, and much later on in life, he revisits this dollhouse that he had in his family his family home, and he opens the front door and literally lets the imaginary friend back out. It's an inventive and very weird sophomore effort for Adam E. Mortimer, who directed Some Kind of Hate in 2015. But I just loved its kind of Cronenbergian energy to it.
A lot of fleshiness, a lot of
Mandy coloring. It looked very Mandy
coloring.
Color, yeah.
It's just got a hypnotic pulse to it that I really enjoyed,
and a bombastic score.
Oh, the score is so good.
Yeah.
The score is very good. But Miles Robbins is great in it. Patrick Schwarzenegger, who plays the imaginary friend, is fantastic. But it's a character study. And you could take it however you want. I mean, like, Adam's been doing some really great interviews about the film, kind of getting under the skin of it. But I just enjoyed its kind of refreshing take on, I think, what was the last imaginary friend movie that had come out?
Drop Dead Fred?
I love Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah. You can only go up
there's
from there.
There's a really good episode of Supernatural on Imaginary
Friends. Oh, is there?
Yeah.
But it was fantastic, and it culminated into a finale that I was just like, I just applauded and had a giant grin on my face because I was like, you know, a filmmaker sets something up really early on and pays it off. I'm just ultimately pleased.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth a look and tracking down.
Yeah.
That was one of the ones I was most disappointed that I watched it on my laptop this year because it was for an interview. Okay, we were going to have Adam on the show.
And we only had we had like one
evening.
It was
right before Beyond
Fest. It was sent to us and we had to watch it immediately.
And I could tell as I was watching it, I was like, oh yeah, I can tell why this would benefit if I got to see this, with the wall shaking the way Mandy did.
Yeah.
The wall
shaking.
So that's one I'm going to rewatch. Yeah. It hasn't made the list yet, but I did like it a lot and I thought it was super smart.
Yeah.
So I will rewatch it.
Yeah. I mean, just like there's that like a kind of reoccurring imagery that occurs that just is the companion to it is just like the great score, like you said, and that rumble. But it's super cool, and it's almost it's like a little bit of a body horror movie too.
Yeah,
so Anyways.
I thought it was a huge leap from his first movie.
Oh, yeah.
Giant.
I love seeing that kind of, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Step.
Yeah. Yeah. I called him after it. I was like, no offense to the first movie. I said there are definitely aspects to that movie I liked, but I was like, this is leaps and bounds better than that movie. You're like growing as a filmmaker, and I love watching that trajectory in filmmakers who are getting their foot in the door, you know, and seeing them grow. If you're not growing, then what's the point?
So you also made that spot. I like where you're going, kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's two I like where you're going, kids. What's your I like where you're going?
Mine is not an I like where you're going, kid. Mine's a very polarizing title, so much so that it made me question why I like it so much. But fuck it. My number 10 is Velvet Buzzsaw.
Dude, I still haven't seen Velvet Buzzsaw.
So, oh, like you had a year.
I know.
No, that's what I mean.
So far, you haven't seen two of the ones.
It literally started.
What are you doing? This is your job.
I didn't hear anyone ever talk about this one when it came out. I'd never heard anyone talk about it.
It was very polarizing.
I talked about it in the second episode of the year, I think.
Yeah, I know I talked about it.
I was on holiday.
So yeah.
Still.
Velvet Buzzsaw, I had heard a lot of dissension about it before I saw it, and then I watched it, and I had a blast. I just thought it was so much fun. And I rewatched it last week thinking, well, maybe I was just in a really good mood when I watched it. Maybe everybody else was right and it's not good. And I had a blast again. So I just really enjoyed this movie. This is Dan Gilroy, who had done Nightcrawler previously. And for me, this movie is Nightcrawler. It's that same level of satire. It's that same level of winking at the audience, this Verhoeven level of you get what I'm doing here, right? But in the art world, it really does feel like a much smarter, more sophisticated version of Corman's Bucket of Blood, where the setup of it is this guy, he's an art dealer. He discovers that the guy upstairs from him has died, and he's walking past his apartment as they're cleaning it out, and this guy has just hundreds of pieces of really creepy artwork, and he steals them. He just like takes them, walks away, and starts displaying them. And every single time one of these pieces gets displayed, supernatural stuff starts happening. But it's not set up as a horror movie. It is set up somewhat like Neon Demon, but Neon Demon, but even pushing it further to the point where it's almost comedic. Like in it, one of the characters dies horribly, but no one touches the body for days because they think it's part of the artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just things like that. And so I loved that this also was not an atmospheric horror film. There is no point where it's like lights out and shadows and crazy movie. The whole thing's like brightly lit art studio. Yeah. And so I just had fun with this one. I thought Gyllenhaal was great. It's got just a top-notch cast to begin with. I think that basically Toni Collette has owned the past 2 years of horror.
Yeah,
and she's phenomenal in this as well. So yeah, Velvet Buzzsaw, which I watched on Netflix.
Nice.
Beautiful. All right. Well, now we're up to number 9. I feel bad because honestly, I totally forgot about Daniel Isn't Real, and that probably would have been my 9 or 8 if I had thought of it.
Yeah.
But I can't leave Larry Fessenden off this list, so my number 9 is Depraved, which is the new movie from Larry Fessenden. It is his modern-day Brooklyn take on Frankenstein. I don't know what else to say without giving much away, because it pretty much plays out kind of in the same way that he tackled vampirism with Habit and the Wendigo with his Wendigo. This isn't as minimalist as those. Like, you do see a guy that's sewn together trying to figure out who the hell he is. But there's just that weird human approach that Larry takes to the characters that you really feel for him. And there's been a lot of interesting takes on Frank. Like, I really loved Bernard Rose did one a couple of years ago that I thought was actually really, really good. Hmm. So this is up there. I mean, it's Fessenden. I know, Elric, you saw it recently.
I liked it a lot. Yeah, I liked it a lot. And this is almost heartbreaking. If you go right now, I've got my list on my letterbox and my list on my thing, and it was in my 10 spot on my letterbox. And then when I wrote it on paper, somehow it didn't get on. So I lost in translation, Larry. But it was around that. I had about three, like I said, about four or five titles that I really, really liked them. Like, a couple things, and maybe one of the towards the end of the act where it stops following a character who you're just so tied to in the point of view, which, you know, but on second view I'll probably see how I feel. But I really like the build up to that film. I like the kind of mad experiment side of it, like this mad scientist for big business kind of concept that's going on in it. We won't go too much more because I feel like hardly anyone's seen Depraved.
Yeah.
So I do think it's probably ripe for you to discover. But it's top tier Fessenden. It's not like...
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to make sure it got a mention on this list. And Joshua Leonard's in it in quite a fun role, I guess. I don't know if it'd be called fun, but... He's a character.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. But it's real, the guy who plays the central
the
character.
Creature. Oh, and he looks
is
great.
Really fantastic. And kind of the way they show how parts of him remember that stuff is really effective.
Yeah, it's really, really cool.
Now, I like that one a lot.
Depraved.
Depraved. One of the films I kicked off this year with, and I couldn't for the life of me remember if it was this year or last, and it's just, you know, again, no one talks about it. It's called, my number nine from India, it was called Tumbad.
Is that the pregnancy one?
No, it's by a guy, Rahi Anil Barve. Yeah. Somebody had recommended, a listener had recommended at the start of the year, and it just, on a visual side.
Well, it stuck with you, huh?
It blew me away. Some of the weird visual, very Hellraiser visuals that are in the lore.
What's it called again?
Tumbad. It was like one that just popped up on Amazon, and like I didn't know what to expect. But it starts with these young boys whose, I think it's their mom, is looking after this old, old woman, kind of witch-type woman in this house. And they basically, who just looks like some sort of monster, witch creature. It's really kind of a frightening kinder trauma start. Once that person is passes away, they realize that there's this like, I guess it's like something, a hole. I can't remember if it's a well or something. But under it, you go deep down into this cavern and basically there's this unlimited gold.
Yeah.
But to get to it, you have to bring pieces of bread to this. Basically, it's a demon. It's basically the devil in the circle that can't leave the circle and will be distracted if you throw the bread at it. And you can go down unlimited. So it's really about greed. It's like, but it's done. If it was just that, and there's even like, you know, like all Indian cinema, there is one little part where there's kind of a musical in the middle, but it never is that movie. That's what I was worried about because I knew that would take me out. But my God, I wasn't ready for the visuals. I just wasn't ready for like when they actually go into this thing, how well done it was. It's pretty. It's kind of just super creepy, and it had just a good story. So it was just one. It would be very easy to leave off this list for other films that I wanted, like Depraved and stuff. But there's a part of me that's like, no one is seeing this.
Yeah.
So if we can shine a light on some of this world cinema, because, you know, our best chance, like you're saying at the top of the show about the diversity out there, you know, diversity isn't just race and gender. Diversity is also the world, you know, in the world. There are so many countries where I'm like, what would a horror film from Estonia be? What was a horror film from? And so this is the first horror film I had seen. I'd seen a lot of films from India with the kind of myth, but I'd never seen a what I would call straight horror film. So I thought it was super cool.
It is
I have
cool.
a list I must give you.
Yeah.
Because I had one of my students last year was very much into kind of Bollywood horror. Yeah. And she left my class with a list of 20 films, 20 must-watch Bollywood horror films. And so I've been working my way through them. There's some really good ones.
And this one, I mean, I know Bollywood's more is a place, but it does seem like it's a style. And in this case, it's not like that. This is very different.
None of the Bollywood horror films that she gave me feel
like that.
They're not musicals. A couple of them have musical numbers, but not in the same capacity. The majority of them function as horror films.
So you have seen Tumbad. You're the one.
I saw a rough cut of Tumbad.
I think back then it was really long or something, right?
It was incredibly long and the visual effects weren't complete.
I think the effects would probably really blow you away now.
Yeah.
Like I think you'd be like, whoa, how'd they pull that off? Yeah. It's also super dark and, you know.
I've been brought in like to like give a little consult on edits and trims and stuff like that.
So. Maybe it worked.
Maybe.
It's on Amazon Prime.
I'm glad.
Very interesting.
I'm glad you discovered it. That's cool.
Tumbad.
My number nine is Babak Anvare's Wounds.
Nice.
Which is currently on Hulu. This is the
now
movie.
Holding our hand, the book.
Yeah.
This movie is best described as truly looking into the mouth of madness. You know, it is a movie that starts off in a pretty unassuming way. It's like a simple setup of you meet Armie Hammer. He owns a bar in New Orleans. There's his friend Zazie Beetz. Dakota Fanning is his love interest. There are a bunch of friends hanging out in the bar, and then a bunch of teenagers come blowing in. They create a drunken mess. One of them leaves a cell phone behind. Armie picks it up while cleaning up. He takes the cell phone home. He putzes around on the cell phone a little bit and discovers something truly nightmarish. And from that point on, it becomes this weird descent into hell with outlandish imagery, you know, decapitated heads and weird messages. And, you know, Armie is just trying to get to the bottom of this mystery of what is exactly going on. Also,
cockroaches.
His best friend.
Lots of cockroaches.
His best friend and, you know, neighbor is also losing his mind.
Has no face.
Yeah. There's just all sorts of – it's just one of those movies that I remember seeing at Sundance. And, you know, the I feel like, and programmers do this, you know, they when they program midnight movies, they get movies that can keep you awake. Mm-hmm. And now at the age of 43, I'm not too keen on midnight movies, and it's hard to keep me awake. But when I sat down for this film, I was just glued to the screen. I was like, where is this thing going? It's completely unpredictable. It becomes a little, it starts to stall out a little bit as it becomes like a character drama between Armie Hammer and Zazie Beetz as they have this romantic thing going on. But in the back of my head, I was like, okay, I'm watching these two get it on in a park. But I knew just around the corner, okay, Babak's showing us this because shit's about to get even worse than we already thought it was. So
I wonder how that one plays second viewing, because once you know what's there, I bet there's other clues all through that.
Well, yeah. And Elric didn't even...
I didn't see the ending.
He didn't see the ending. There's something at the end that's kind of concealed that he
like
didn't even
see. Like the innkeepers
see.
Or something.
Like the innkeepers where you have to watch it. And so I saw it. Yeah. And then the next night you came over to my place to do the podcast and I was like, did you not love the ending? And he was like, what?
So
and I made him watch it again. I was like, there, look at that.
I had to see it on computer. No, but I like, so this isn't on my list, but, and I was telling Ryan right before this, I've thought about this film more than any film this year since seeing it, and it probably a couple months from now, it'd be probably high on my list, weirdly enough. So it's a weird feeling.
I genuinely wish the movie got a little bit of a larger platform for release, like Midsommar did. Because I feel like there would be a dialogue about it more so than the dialogue that it received for those who discover that it suddenly just popped up on Hulu. Weekends.
It was being attacked on Letterboxd. It was like all half stars at the first day. And I was like, what
I remember
is that?
That.
And it was all about the actors. And I don't know why they're attacking them. Maybe
I think
thing.
It's the same reason that, if you remember, I think I compared her to watching.
Really,
what was it? She's like the acting version of paint drawing or something like that. But I mean, once I started looking at it again, I think that that's part of it is that she's supposed to be completely devoid of personality.
It has to be a choice.
It has to be. She's just so
well, so is Arnie
dry.
In a sense. He's so kind of living such an empty life. That's why he's a good vessel, right?
Yeah.
Like it's definitely one of those late in the season movies that I think people should check out.
I just read the very first popular review for this film on Letterboxd. Armie Hammer, who is a millennial, says, fucking millennials about a group of Gen Zers.
Criticism's alive and well.
Yeah, criticism, man. No, it's definitely an acquired taste, but you know, it hit all the right spots that I love, and it's just a genuinely weird entry in my list.
Even if you didn't like the drama, the horror beats are so interesting.
Cool. Wounds. That one's on Hulu right now.
Wounds is on Hulu.
So my number nine is, this is where am I like what you did there. I can't wait to see more. And this is The Headhunter. So I saw this one super early in the year. I got a screening link of this ahead of time because we have the same management. And this was like forwarded over to me as like, holy shit, Becky, you're going to love this. It's so super gory. And I completely fell in love with it. And I was so excited to see it get such a good reception. Like looking at it right now, it's like 5 stars on Rotten Tomatoes. This is from Jordan Downey, the guy who did Thanksgiving, which was just wacky and splat sticky and spoofy.
That's very similar, right?
No, not in any capacity. And then to go to this is one medieval warrior. You don't really get much of a backstory. You know that he has a daughter who is killed by a monster. And then he spends the rest of the movie hunting monsters and putting their heads on stakes to try to find this one monster that killed his daughter. And there's a lot of weird alchemy going on and a lot of weird kind of chemistry in a medieval sense going on that we don't necessarily get. But
he's pickling a lot.
Yeah, he pickles. He pickles a lot of things. but
the pickling is for a reason, though.
Yeah.
And it plays a significant plot. Yeah.
It does. Yeah. That's why I refer to it as alchemy. Like it's getting there. Like, but I was so fascinated by this visually, and then reading the backstory of how they shot it. Because I mean, the majority of the movie, you're watching one person, and kind of monsters drift in and out. But even with the minuscule budget that they had, the production value that they gave to it, like I have been singing the praises of this film all year, and I can't recommend it enough to check it out. That is The Headhunter. Super, super micro budget, but just an amazing attempt that really pushed far from the filmmaker's first film.
Yeah, I finally watched it this weekend. Could not believe the budget. Like it just looks like it just, I mean, they kind of just played it out perfectly. So you're not noticing. I mean, you just don't see the corners being cut. You see the minimalism of what they're shooting, but what's in the frame does not look, ever look cheap. And that's like, to me, like real art. What is it? Like 50 grand, 25
yeah,
grand,
like,
something?
It was super low.
Yeah, it's not something insane. Mm-hmm. But, and even the guy, he's actually from Iceland or something. So it's not like, you know, the actor is even looks expensive.
And I mean, the whole thing is set in a cabin. It's a cabin and then this like snowy wooded landscape. Yeah. But because of all of this kind of medieval brutality and gruesomeness in the production and the costuming design, I mean, it looks like a Molly Hatchet album cover or something that would like be painted on the side of a van. It's just like this picturesque medieval warrior persona. And so you kind of get lost in that along with the monster effects, which are really good.
Yeah, that's definitely one we should definitely try to get them in the new year just to talk about how you even get something like that.
I have a connection. I can do that, guys.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, I'm looking at the German Blu-ray where it's called Viking Vengeance.
Viking Vengeance, that's awesome.
But yeah, this one's a Shudder exclusive right now, mm-hmm. I think, right? That's where you watch it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, it's on Shudder. I've been meaning to check it out, so.
It would be a great double feature with Berserker.
Well, I don't know about that.
That could be called Viking Vengeance. I'm just kidding.
All right, so we're up to number 8. Yeah. For me, I saw this actually after it played in theaters. It's Annabelle Comes Home. I like what the Conjuring universe does for the most part. You know, there's been a few here and there that have not landed as well as the Conjuring movies that James himself directs. But overall, more times than not, they're actually pretty solid, scary, and really well put together. You know, this year I think had The Nun, which I was lukewarm on, although there's stuff in it I liked a lot. The Curse of La Llorona, which actually I kind of liked that one too, even though I didn't love it. This is the one that stood out, and I think obviously it's because, not just because of the character Annabelle, but because of the approach to it. And again, it's like a horror Jumanji where, you know, you have a really cool, fun hook where it's kids at home. And it's that room where all the artifacts are and like a little bit of everything kind of wreaking havoc. And so, you know, it's like a Monster Mash movie almost, you know, because there's a werewolf in there at one point and you get a lot of really interesting, cool stuff. And also, there's part of me that almost, you know, you kind of like curse the teenage character that is over for even messing with Annabelle, but then you kind of find out why, and then you're like, all right, there's actually a heart to the story and all that. So just in terms of pure theatrical fun and spectacle, I just thought it was a really solid, you know, studio movie.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. So that one sits outside my list, but it definitely gets recognition because I just had such a good time with it. I still call it Annabelle Sleepover, though.
That's actually a great title.
I know. I can't think of it any other way because that's exactly what it is. It's a slumber party that happens in the house where Annabelle is hanging out.
Both those Annabelle sequels to me are great. I'm not I really almost couldn't get through the first one. I think first I love Sandberg's. I think he just kills it with his scares. And then this one was like such a fun movie, you know? Again, yeah, not quite on my list, but it was definitely one of the more fun films I saw this year.
All right.
I love my number 8, and I think Becca loved this one too. That is Jan Gonzalez. Alice's Knife Plus Heart.
Oh, God, yeah.
This movie is just an aesthetic feast if you're a fan of the film Cruising. There's references from that. It's set in the 70s French porn world where a French filmmaker, she's been making a successful series of, you know, theatrical porn films, so back when it was playing in theater. And then basically a very Cruising-esque masked S&M killer starts killing the people associated with her film. And I don't even remember much about the plot beyond that. I remember there's some interesting, you know, love story between her and her editor, some backstory that's like a giallo.
I do because it's my number 8 as well, so I might as well just jump in here.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So yeah, my number 8 was Knife Plus Heart as well, so good job. No, I love this movie so much. This was by far one of my favorite theatrical screenings of the year.
Definitely, yeah,
definitely. So the back story was that she is in love with her editor, but her editor is no longer in love with her, and so she is going through this intense breakup while also trying to deal with the fact that her actors are being killed and that she's trying to save this company, which is going through some financial problems as well. So she's trying to remake these films at the same time, and you can also get and maybe this is just reading it as a female, but you can get notes that she's feeling her own age as well. Because there was a lot of kind of about, you know, the screen capturing image, the screen capturing youth, and her talking about how she doesn't feel quite as fresh as she once did. Like, she feels like she's been hung up to dry.
And she's played by Vanessa Paradis, who was Johnny Depp's, you know, longtime wife up until a few years ago. Yeah. And she was a major pop star in France.
And it's worth mentioning that Jan Gonzalez is the brother of the frontman for M83, who did the soundtrack.
Oh, cool.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
But it's like, reminds me, if you like something like Drive or Nick Griffin films, it's got some of the aesthetics of that, like in terms of pop kind of a sound and really lush imagery, but it's also, it's just more fun. It's got a darker backstory. It's playing with giallos. It's playing with cruising. It's playing, you see all these references, but you've never seen it through this lens.
Yeah, and there's so much being put up there. Like, you will see the giallo stuff, but at the same time, you're seeing this very kind of cruising 1980s kind of grungy aesthetic. And then at the same time, they'll go to the park, and there's this absolutely beautiful like white pastel palette that emerges all of a sudden, and it feels almost like a Worley and Borowski film.
Yeah, it's like the weird flashbacks.
Yeah, like it suddenly feels like The Beast for a little bit, but that's all kind of pulling from almost the same kind of TNA exploitation world. Mm. So yeah, it's delicate. I can call the film delicate and grisly at the same time.
Yeah, I think this one, I felt like it was going to be a big splash when it first hit, and I don't feel like I've been, I think when it first played at like, was South By or was it Fantastic, it was getting a lot of love, and then I just didn't hear much more about it. And I think, this to me is like, it's going to be like a little bit of a modern classic, not necessarily like for people looking for scares and horror, but more like just the style and the feel.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely one of those early supporters of it. It didn't stick with me as much as I wanted it to, and I think it just didn't, I don't know. I think a lot of the payoff it wasn't rewarded. I think by like sticking around through the mystery of it all. I don't know. It just didn't feel rewarded.
Giallos rarely pay off.
I know. It was, but I do love the style. I love the soundtrack. I mean, I love the approach to it. But,
yeah, it's just something different if you're looking for it. So yeah, but it's a lot of fun. Good. Watch it with cruising and have a blast.
Yeah. My number 8 is The Headhunter. This is how you do a big world on a very small budget. Very minimal storytelling, in terms of the coverage, Jordan picked and chose, he was like very picky and choosy about how much he wanted to show every time. As Becca said, every time our warrior, stepped off to answer the call of a monster, because there was a castle nearby where he would just hear these horns, and that meant he had to go into battle. We would just see the aftermath of that battle, which meant he was dragging home ahead. But, it was just surprisingly, emotional. I felt for this guy. And I just stuck with that. I don't know. It's really tight, as you said, it doesn't overstay its welcome. The one thing is that I don't want to spoil too much, but I do. I'd love to have conversations about the finale, but it's really, really well done and just incredibly surprising considering that filmmaker's background.
I remember when I first told you about this, you were like, is that the Thanksgiving guy? And I was like, need to watch it.
Yeah. And I met with him generally here, and we have conversations, but a really smart guy. And he's just got I think he's got a very promising career ahead of him. It was definitely a surprise for this year, and I definitely recommend it. I just love the ambition and the pacing of it, the look of the movie, the vistas that they shot on him. It's just great.
And the lead looks like a Nordic buff Jeremy Gardner.
So it does, fan of Jeremy, right?
I mean, literally, there were some shots where I thought it was him.
I will admit to doing an IMDb check about 5 minutes in, because I was like, wait a minute, why do I recognize this guy? Holy shit, is that Jeremy Gardner?
I know. And then but when he takes off his shirt, this guy's buff as hell, and you're like,
So what we're saying, Jeremy, is you look like a Viking.
Yeah, basically.
A buff Viking.
Somewhere he's drinking beer, and he's like, yes.
He can do straight to video sequels, so that's cool.
Since it's coming out next year, what was that thing in the bar of Jeremy's after midnight?
Oh, so gross.
What's it called, a gorilla fart?
Where you take whatever's on the...
Have you seen After Midnight yet? Or no?
So the part where you put plastic thing you put your drinks on, it's like made out of...
At the bar.
At the bar.
The anti-skid thing?
Right.
So well,
Yeah, it's like the anti-skid thing.
It's like the bumpy thing that keeps all your shot glasses from like sliding off the bar when it's wet.
So if the guy's desperate enough to want to drink,
he orders a gorilla fart.
You drink the spillover.
They pour all the spillover.
And it could be anything that was in there, and it's just.
But the greatest thing is that someone named themselves that as a trivia team in Knoxville.
Oh yeah, they did.
Anyway, sorry. Sorry to derail.
Something for you to look forward to next year, guys.
So we are on to seven.
We're on seven.
So my number seven is Ready or Not, believe it or not.
Nice.
I didn't see it right away. I think this and Crawl are the two biggest hype movies that as soon as they dropped, like everybody was talking about it. And I liked the trailer and all, but I didn't really have an interest in going to see it initially. I was like, oh, that looks kind of cool. But the fact that it universally, like so many people went to see it and loved it and were having a great time, I was like, all right, maybe I do need to see this with an audience on the big screen. And if you don't know, obviously it's Samara Weaving is the bride to be. She's been doing a lot of amazing stuff in the last couple of years. She was great in Joe Lynch's movie Mayhem, The Babysitter.
You guys still need to check out Picnic at Hanging Rock, the new
one.
She is the lead in that, and it's amazing. This is the Amazon miniseries that came out last year that I raved about. She's the lead.
She's terrific. So she carries this whole movie. She's getting married to this guy. She's meeting his weird family, and basically they need to pick and play a game before
as part of the tradition
before the night is over, and obviously the game is kind of deadly, not exactly what you think. So this is very darkly funny. At least the situation is kind of ridiculous because of how over the top it gets, but it's played straight and she's playing it straight. And more than anything, I was a little bummed that I felt like the trailer gave away a little too much of the movie, which I probably would have enjoyed it more had I not known those beats. But that said, it's such a satisfying ending that really brought it home for me. And when I walked out, I was walking to my car thinking like, wow, that was a really good time.
Yeah.
So just for sheer over-the-top gore and fun, Ready or Not. That's
like the best
seven.
Double feature of the year would be that and Knives Out, in my opinion, because they're similar worlds, but very different approaches. That one for me at the family was a little over the top at the time, but like it stuck with me, so I keep thinking about it and laughing about it. So yeah, and she's so good in that film. That's a really fun one. We talked about that one a bit on Becca's Nightmare University, where he did 1% horror. So it was like looking at how the rich eat the poor.
The rich are literally feeding off the poor before they can become part of the 1%. They have to prove themselves.
Oh, that's a good catalyst.
Subgenre.
Yes, that subgenre. My number seven, again, speaking of movies that you're like, yeah, it's interesting when you see it in theaters and stuck with me, took Seeing a Seagull on the way to Salem for this one to make my number seven.
Oh, geez.
I'm pretty sure I'm the only one who's going to have it. Robert Eggers, The Lighthouse.
By the way, I really like, because Elric is sitting right next to me just to paint a picture, and he's got this white piece of paper.
I don't understand.
He's
like,
folding back. He's folding back his entries without me seeing them.
There's some mad origami going on here.
He doesn't want to give the suspense. Yeah, I got my laptop slightly turned.
I mean, Ryan keeps like hogging the desk space here.
So expectations are always tricky. It's hard to follow up movies like The Witch, and to do it in a way that when I heard it played at Cannes and heard it was rapturously taken in at Cannes, which is kind of weird when it's a black and white monochrome film with these kind of two seafarers in a lighthouse, I was kind of like, what the hell is this going to be? And we all saw it, and I wouldn't say I was underwhelmed. I was just so not sure what to expect. And then when you get what you're getting, it's really a tale of madness. Like I had to walk away from it first going, okay, this isn't all out, all in, crazy horror like it could have been, and it pushes towards. But then when I walked away from it and started thinking about it, I was like, oh yeah, but it's such an interesting, funny, strange world. Like, and it really has stuck with me, actually. Of all the movies, another one of those ones I keep sometimes just thinking of little moments from it. I think the humor is really good. I think like it has still got this touch of Lovecraftian madness to it for sure, in terms of setting and the weird kind of phallus stuff between these two men and the kind of this vibe that maybe one is the other and kind of like persona. So obviously somebody wears those Bergman influences on his, on the outside pretty obviously, but I like what he's doing, and I like when we talked to him, which was definitely one of the easier interviews we've ever done. I liked that he made it very clear that he was taking risks. Like after Hereditary, that's the other guy. After The Witch, he could have done anything like a Nosferatu, but he chose to do this because after that you're not going to get to, because this movie is really specific. I totally know it's not for everyone, but I think it's increasingly becoming for me. Even though there's parts of me that want it to go all out. I want some crazy tentacle monsters, never got it. That's okay. I still got a little hints of some mer creature. Cool. Becca's looking at me with dirty eyes.
I'm sorry, I was not. I was okay
dirty
with
eyes.
This film.
She yeah. me dirty eyes.
Dirty Whoa. Eyes.
Because I said mer creature. Yeah. That's her line.
No, there was like 2 seconds of mer creature.
Yeah,
like
pretty
I was
sexy mer creature.
I gotta say, it left me cold.
And
but,
lots of farts. Yeah. Lots of fart jokes. You don't like fart jokes? What's your problem?
I did like, don't you like me lobster?
Yeah. And what's wrong with this cooking? You don't like my cooking?
You don't like me lobster?
I do think Willem Dafoe is pretty amazing.
Where are we on number seven. My number seven is Crawl.
Yeah, that nice. Movie's so fun.
I think this is the perfect place for it on the list. It's Alex Aja doing what he does best with a super high concept, which is hurricane, woman in peril, dog in peril, woman under the house trying to get her dad, who is also in peril, alligators. Yeah. And it's just, you know, with that high concept, I think Aja just delivers on relentless gator mm-hmm. attacks, a lot of clever twists and turns. What happens, what happens when the eye of the hurricane blows over? And it's just, it's exactly what it needed to be.
Yeah,
and
I went in. Stuff's cool.
And I went, what's that?
Father-daughter connection's really cool.
It's a yeah. little, it's a little on the nose, a little campy, but you know what? I mean, like, I went with my family. I went with my wife and daughter, and they just got so taken by the melodrama of it all, too. It couldn't help but get swept up in it as well. But it's just a lot of fun, a lot of great jump scares. I just wish Aja would get more work because he clearly is having fun still staying in the horror space. Mm-hmm. And I think that Krull demonstrates that he's definitely got a few more great scares up his sleeve. You know, I jumped multiple times during that stupid movie. I was just like, God damn it, movie.
And it's produced by someone decent, too.
Sam Raimi.
Yeah. And so I think like when he gives that kind of support to him or to Fetty or somebody, you see like movies that I think they are. Really
I've never talked about this on the show because I did not see it in theaters and I rented it on Amazon the week it dropped and I just.
What?
I get everything that's happening and maybe it would have not been as obvious on the big screen. I just can't get over the CG.
They didn't look bad to me.
No, on the screen they weren't bad. I mean, there were parts of the movie
it's all.
Well, maybe your super high tech TV that pulls.
Yeah. I mean, there were other parts of the movie that I had major plot point problems with that I was willing to overlook. For some reason, their kitchen floors are made of crackers, but that shower door is like fucking Teflon. But I am going to overlook all of that shit for giant alligators.
That's the thing. You get to overlook this stuff.
That Teflon door.
Compared to Alligator, the movie, which is great in that regard. But I don't know. Like, I know this sounds goofy, but like, I enjoy the Killer Crocodile movies that Severn put out more. Because it's an actual...
Killer Crocodile was... It's a good movie.
Alligators that eat, you know, kids and people.
Did you guys see Quentin's... somebody posted the other day that Quentin Tarantino's top three films of the year were like Crawl and another one that's going to come up on the show later. And I was like, holy shit, that's awesome.
I saw that.
He loves Crawl.
That's top news.
Yeah, I just love that he loves Crawl.
Quentin Tarantino loves Crawl. Yeah.
I don't know. And you know what? It might be a thing with that because there are movies I've seen on the... It's why I don't really...
If you're a newcomer to the show, Rob's just got this high-end viewing system in his home. That's 3D, and it makes it... Rob comes into the office, and he's like, guys, I watched Blade Runner, and it felt like Harrison Ford was sitting on my couch.
If I can't stare at his eyelashes...
I've never said that statement before, ever. He's lying.
Three of us will all confirm that you said that word for word.
We totally heard it, Rob. Why are you denying it?
It would have been the second Blade Runner, because that's the one in 3D. But anyway...
No, I don't know.
It's just Annihilation was another one that I recognized that there's a great story there, but none of the bear stuff works for me because when I watch
that
it,
part
at
was
home,
so good
it,
in theaters.
It
all, so
but it,
good.
It's fake.
Why?
It's uncanny valley to me.
But why in the theater wasn't it? Because in the theater that wasn't.
Well,
for me.
I don't know. I mean, is the theater like a grainier projection than it is like on our home television?
Yeah, it could be the distance you're from the screen.
Yeah.
But that is interesting. Yeah, that bear scene is like one of the best.
I love it.
Car scenes recently. Yeah. But anyway, that's interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for being honest.
Yeah.
You know.
Where are we?
I'm right here. Okay. My number seven, In Tall Grass. Nice. This is just me. I love Vincenzo. Like, Cube was such a huge film for me. You guys know how much I love those movies where it's a group of people shoved in a room and then they have to figure out why the hell they're there. Not the Saw versions where they have to slam blast each other's knees to figure out why they're there, but just you just have to talk and figure it out. And this was it. I love when Vincenzo does puzzles. And so this was a puzzle for me. There was even, he did this TV series a couple of years ago called Darknet, where the first episode, which was by him, was like a puzzle of the internet and how people are connected, and it was brilliant and I loved it, and then the show fell apart after that, but that first episode was what I love about Vincenzo. And this was too, where it was just a group of people who can't get out of the situation and they have to figure out why they're there and what they need to do to overcome it. And I just had the blast with it. And when time started looping, I was like, I am just so into this. It was just wonderful for me. So I had a blast.
I do love it. I have a funny Vincenzo story, which I hope is okay, but I used to work at Amoeba in Hollywood in the video department, my video store job. And sometimes people call up and put something on hold under their name. And so I had a package for Vincenzo, and the guy came up, and I looked at it, and it was a copy of Cube on DVD, and I just remember handing it to him and being like, did you direct this movie? And he's like, I need a copy for a meeting or something. I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. Yeah. But yeah, that always cracks me up when you, because it's like, that's not a common name, and it's the movie Cube, which is for the director who, all right, there you go.
One of the greatest episodes of any podcast I've ever heard was, because he's also a real cinephile, is him and Keith, is it Keith Gordon? Keith Gordon from Christine.
Oh, my God,
it was the two of them, Keith, all about The Shining for about 2 hours. It was on the projection booth, and the two of them, these two cinephiles, are talking about how big an influence that was on them, and they were so interesting to listen to the two of them. It's a really good episode if you ever track it down.
I gotta try to get Keith Gordon on this show.
I want to get Vincenzo on this show, too.
Yeah. Talk Billie Jean.
Yeah.
Legend of Billie Jean.
Yeah. Oh, God, I love Legend of Billie Jean.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I feel like we need a new version of that. I could see an update. Well,
wait, that's
internet
what the new
culture?
Movie was that came out this week. And Slim. It's kind of like a Billie Jean.
Queen and Slim.
Queen and Slim. It looks like a Bonnie Clyde movie.
Because Legend of Billie Jean was all about like creating your own hype and creating a movement.
It was a Me Too
to
movie
change.
Before Me Too.
Yeah.
But also about all the people trying to help you.
Yeah,
help
along the way. Yeah. Like, I feel like there's a really big internet culture version of that.
Yeah.
Just give me an associate producer credit who out there just heard that and has
greenlit
it.
Just greenlit it.
Give me an E. I'll take an EP.
All right, we're up to number six. For me, it's It Chapter 2. And again, another one that I timing-wise, I missed it in theaters. And I talked about it maybe 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was even last week. I can't remember now. But I love the book. I love the 1990 miniseries. I actually like the miniseries a little bit more just because I think it's more faithful. That's just a personal thing. Like, that's the version of the story that I grew up with and love. I like the first movie a lot. I think it's better than the second one. However, I just love these characters so much. And seeing these new actors, in particular Bill Hader, take them on, it just kind of – any issues I may have with the second movie – are kind of trumped by the fact that I just love these characters so much. And I loved being able to spend another 2.5 hours with them in this capacity. The ending never really landed in any version. So it's kind of surprised that it didn't work here either. But just in terms of, it's just fascinating to me that this is, for a lot of young kids, this is their modern horror icon. When they see an image of this version of Pennywise, it's going to be the equivalent of what Freddy Krueger is to us. Yes. Like, there's a whole generation of people that will instantly see that clown and recognize, oh, that's Pennywise from It. So I actually think these movies complement each other really well together. And so, I don't know, maybe one Sunday I'll do the nice long double feature of it. And also, when I watched it, there was a great documentary that kind of went into the making of one and two back to back. And again, it's just, I just loved, I think when it was first announced, Ryan said something really funny, which is, I can't remember, you're like, I've seen plenty of, you know, Jason movies or whatever. I've only got one it. I'm down for more of that. Which basically is like, we've only seen this story once. So I think we're okay to see it again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I just dig that. Again, this isn't my preferred version of it, but I dig it. I dig that there's a new version of it, and this is it. So, yeah. It's pretty high on my list.
And
number six.
It definitely will become kind of this generation's Freddy, because, I mean, my six-year-old knows who Pennywise is.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, she has heard about it at school. It's the kids talking about it and talking about what they think the movie is. And they you know, tell stories about Pennywise, even though that none of them in, you know, first grade have seen this movie. It definitely is developing this kind of larger than life persona that Freddy yeah. had when we were a kid, where I remember playing Freddy before I'd ever seen a Freddy movie. So, yeah, it's definitely kind of on its own.
I remember that first screening of Freddy not knowing, and I think I've told this to you before where I show up, and they had already just watched it but didn't tell me. So they pretended like they had just gone on VHS for the first time. No one knew who Freddy was. They put on Nightmare on Elm Street, and that first time where he first pops out, somebody jumped on me, and I honestly almost peed my pants. It was so scary. Yeah, that movie is so scary when
you're a kid. It is incredibly scary. I was going to say, unlike our generation, when we had Freddy and Jason, we didn't have action figures and merch out the water. Zoo,
yeah.
At least not to the degree that today's generation has, when you can walk into a Hot Topic and suddenly it has its own like section of the store, and there's like action figures and clothes.
But we did have the Fresh Prince Nightmare on my street,
which is a fucking classic,
right?
Yes,
yeah.
But I'm just I don't know. Maybe we need a little more time away from these. Mm-hmm. But I'm just so fascinated how, in particular, the first one, just that like. That it and that Pennywise really hit the zeitgeist. And it, like, the second one did well, but not nearly as well as that. And a lot of other King properties in the last couple of year or two have not done nearly as well as that first it. Beck and I were doing the Blumhouse website, and, you know, every horror site reposts the it trailer when it drops. Mm-hmm. That one was
exploded.
Wild. Like, I'd never seen that attention for anything since we did it. So. I don't know. It's interesting that's going to be this decade's
movie. Massive, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that was my number six.
Nice. Speaking of action figures.
Here he comes. He's folding the paper back. Yeah. What do we have?
He's making a swan, ladies and gentlemen.
Speaking of action figures, I cannot wait for the action figure 4, Hagazusa. A Heathen's Curse, because when they make that action figure of her on LSD or whatever the fuck happens in this movie, this is one of those ones that I don't even know if I liked it when I was watching it, but my God, next to Wounds, I've thought about this movie more than any movie this year. It just has this weird rhythm, and it's just something about it. I think, like The Witch, it's completely authentic. I mean, they nail, and Headhunters, they nail this period, and this was literally a German film made as a guy's thesis, and in a million years you would not know. I mean, it's a completely professional looking production. It's like pretty astounding. It has some pretty grotesque stuff towards the end that I don't even know if I'll ever want to watch again. It's like pretty heavy. But in terms of just like setting to look, I'm a mood person. Like if somebody gets me and goes, here's dread from start to finish, and they nail that the whole way, I tend to like kind of buy into something. This is set in like kind of the German countryside. What would it be? What century was this?
It's like dark times. Yeah, I mean, like it's pre-medieval times, I would say. This is like, you know, I live in a dirt hut and eat roots time period.
But this will sound weird, but this, even more than The Witch for me, this film made me understand, because we went to Salem this year, and, you know, then you're surrounded by the history. You start reading up about the Salem witch trials, and this movie got in my brain more, the mentality of, oh, if you're somebody who lives in this kind of place and you believe some of these things, and then people start believing something about you, even if it's not true, you then start believing some of that about yourself because of the time, and it can drive you to madness. And it charts it brilliantly. And it's a movie that I totally get why it's polarizing. I totally get the people who really can't watch it. But I enjoyed it.
There wasn't much. I think that
there's not much that happens.
It's the pacing. That was it. I remember that you had texted me the night that this came out.
Tarkovsky's The Witch.
That was it. It was Tarkovsky's The Witch. So you had forwarded me a link that you had, and you were like, what are you doing? Do you want to watch a witch movie? It just came out here. This sounds like your bag, because it's got like this cool like metal image to it. And I remember that night I was ironing, and I was like sitting there watching it on the TV, and I was ironing, and I was like, nothing's happening. Nothing's still happening. Nothing. Well, that was kind of cool. Wait, no, now nothing's happening.
But it does get pretty bonkers. And I mean,
it does. It blows up at the end, I will say.
It's a really great performance, and it's a really fragile character. Again, kind of you see a bit more of this kind of Bergman influence, but you see this character who's driven quite mad, and there's a sequence with eating mushrooms that is really, from there on, you get this really kind of trip style, and I think that's where it does do something unique.
But that was confusing for me, because she's going through all this shit, and then she just sits down and starts crying and looks down at the ground and is like, I'll eat your lawn clippings, and then just has at them. It just came out of nowhere.
But you're ironing. You can't criticize her for doing nothing. You're ironing. No, but I do recommend people who are, like, if you like The Witch,
it's very,
and
yeah.
you like movies like that, give it a shot.
It's The Witch with less action.
Yeah, but more acid. So, you know, that's a coin flip, right?
I will say it's on my honorable mention list because, like yeah. you, it's one that I could not stop thinking about. Only the ending. It was literally like watching, no offense, yeah. paint dry for an hour and a half to suddenly go, holy shit.
Don't keep looking at me. I'm cold on that one.
Yeah. Oh, really? But you love heathens.
I do love heathens and I do love witches, but you know,
the ending was explosive.
It's, I also don't like homework, and when you guys had recommended it, I kind of felt like it was homework.
Yeah, I haven't watched yet. I don't do their homework.
Explosive ending.
I mean, listen, the filmmaker is definitely somebody to watch. I'm backpedaling now, but I mean, it, you know, rightfully so. But you know, it, like, it just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Like that's the thing. It just wasn't for me.
That's how I'll say it as well. Like, I loved a lot of the imagery. It was
Hagazusa and Lucas Fiegelfeld from Munich.
Yep,
it was for me.
And that one's on Shudder and Amazon Prime.
And Amazon, yep.
Yeah.
All right. This is where we delve into TV.
Okay, number six.
My number six is What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, the show.
Yeah, one of those rarities in which the television show, I believe, has surpassed the film.
I would say so as well.
I mean, like, look, you can't go into it going, harumph, it's a TV show based on the movie. It's the same creators and the same team. And I think that FX giving these guys the runway to explore that world even further only benefited and gave them more creative freedom to do whatever the fuck they wanted and not be beholden to going down the kind of like pipeline of development hell of trying to get a second film off the ground. You know, these guys used the network system to go, you know what? We're going to create an entire world on television and that's how you're going to be able to basically get a sequel. And here we get different characters, still vampires, these guys living in Staten Island. But it's just, it is incredibly witty and very funny and like tear inducing. Like, I mean, literally been brought to tears watching this stupid show.
Yeah. I can only describe it as guffawing.
I'm exhausted sometimes watching it, dying
from laughter on some of it.
And if you're worried about, you know, where its place is in the What We Do in the Shadows world, they literally bring in the guys from the film as well. So
I haven't made it to that part yet. I have watched the first couple and liked a lot. But how can you top in the movie The Beast?
I love it
every time he says The Beast.
They totally top it.
Yeah. There's a character played by Doug Jones, which is pretty close it's to the amazing. Beast in a different way.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think Colin Robinson has to be
about it.
Colin Robinson is my favorite new character of the year.
The energy vampire?
The energy vampire.
Colin Robbins is amazing.
The episode where there's the other woman who's in the office who also drains people. That was just
I forget her name because her name isn't like an anagram for like also energy vampire. Eve. And he's like, oh, damn it.
I think the MVP for me is actress Natasia. I've been blanking on her. How should you pronounce her last name? Demetrio. She is just fantastic. I mean, like, my favorite line that I always just like, I always reference is just shame bats who feel shame. It's just so fucking good. It's just like, oh my God.
Right. The episode where her husband gets caught by animal control as in bat form. And so he's stuck in, like, they have to break him out. And he can't transform because he's in a can. Yeah.
So good.
The shame bats is like, he comes across because they have to put on an orgy.
Yes. Because we're the Doug Jones character.
And what happens if the orgy goes bad? There have been vampires who have just transformed into bats and never changed back
because
they feel incredible shame for not putting on the worst orgy. And they cut to a still photograph. And it's just a little baby bat just laying on the floor, like all downtrodden.
All right, I got to finish that because I did love the first couple. I've just watched very little TV.
It's amazing.
For people who can do the deep research, there's also another spinoff series in New Zealand right now called Wellington Paranormal, and it's the two cops from the first movie investigating other paranormal creators.
Shit. Has that been released over here?
It's in New Zealand.
No, but I mean, like, could we buy the Blu-ray?
I don't know if it is, but
New
if
Zealand.
You can crack the internet where like, you can find codes from other
people, we don't pirate around here.
And be like, send that over to me.
But look it up, Wellington Paranormal. I haven't heard too much about it, but I know it sounds fun because it's still set in that first world.
Right.
And I think Jermaine is still at the helm of it, and somehow. So
nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. So
there's
cool
three
world.
Seasons of it. Jesus.
Oh,
jeez. Okay. Wow. Okay. There you go. I did not know that much.
Wow. Oh, it's got like one of the officers has got have a garlic necklace around his neck. That's funny. Huh.
Yeah. So anyway.
The yeah. Continues. What are we doing in the shadows?
Well, it looks like all of us are going to let that fly. So that's
I'm still writing like down Wellington Paranormal.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
A shame pet.
So my number six, we're on six now, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. My number six is everything that I love in the world. It's perfection. The perfection
from
Netflix.
I'm so glad I made your list because I was like, this has to make Becca's list.
I loved this movie so much. Yeah. So I am a massive fan of one, South Korean revenge films, mm-hmm. and then two, the Japanese filmmaker Sion Sano. And it's like they somehow had a baby and made an American Lifetime movie, but it's all fucked up. And I loved it so much just because I never knew where it was going. I was constantly watching with my mouth agape, just going, oh my God, I can't believe they're going there. And it was because it was Netflix and because it got the hype that it did, it was like my mom was calling me up to discuss it. And I love that. She did the same thing the prior year with Bird Box, where I suddenly get this call from my mom going, honey, I know you like horror films. Have you seen Bird Box? And this time it was, have you seen Perfection?
Oh my God.
What did you think of the maggots and the weird, you know, all this other stuff? And I'm just, this is, it's
so fun. I can imagine it gets
Mrs.
pretty McKendry. Weird and dark by the end.
Yeah, I love it. So, yeah, I had a blast with this one. And it does. It gets super dark, but it's what I love about South Korean revenge films, which I know Rob's a huge fan of as well. Yeah. Where it will set up this absolutely horrible, dark situation, but then goes so far off the rails, it literally melts your brain.
Yeah.
And Sion Sano, like I most compare this to the Sion Sano film Strange Circus, which does the exact same thing, where it sets up this incredibly dark, bleak, just abhorrent situation, but then it goes so freaking crazy that you kind of lose all that in the mix, which is where I thought this was. So that is the perfection.
I won't lie. That was one of the more fun things I saw this year, where you just like have to surrender to yourself. I bet a lot of people aren't putting on lists because they think it's too absurd, but it's cool.
I loved it for its absurdity.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, it was like, it was one of those things that weekend everybody was talking about.
Yeah,
that was kind of fun.
Yeah, totally.
Kind of a communal thing.
And also, what's the actress name from Get Out and Girls?
Natasha.
Allison Williams.
She's excellent in it. Like, she holds this, she makes this somehow feel like it's really happening. Otherwise,
so is Stephen Weber.
Yes, no, Stephen Weber gets to shine. Yep, for sure. He gets a pretty crazy role.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, since we're up to five, why don't we take a quick break?
Stand
break. Hear from our sponsor again, and we'll be right back.
Cool. I got to pee.
Your homepage for horror is here. Fangoria.com is now live and brimming with the digital horror content that you crave. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. They're taking the time to aggregate the most important news in horror in one space to save you time and sanity. You'll also find long-form pieces, deep dives, and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Right now, all current subscribers to the magazine are automatically members of Fangoria.com. And as promised, the content in the new issues will forever be print-only. So if you're not already a subscriber, check out the new Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use the promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now. Fangoria.com.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the Nick Taylor Horror Show podcast. Attention, horror filmmakers. Would you like free filmmaking advice from some of the latest and greatest horror directors? The Nick Taylor Horror Podcast is your go-to masterclass in horror filmmaking. Featuring interviews with guests like Joe Dante, Mick Garris, Roger Corman, Stuart Gordon, Tom Holland, and Mitzi Peroni, each episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show explores and deconstructs the successful strategies of horror directors while summarizing the key insights and resources that you can use in your own horror filmmaking journey. This includes their creative process, strategies for getting their first films off the ground, favorite books and tools, key life lessons, and much, much more. Download and subscribe to the Nick Taylor Horror Show today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere you listen, or visit nicktaylor.com for more information.
So
Okay, and we are back, and this is it, the top five. I feel like the picks that we just had from 6 to 10, you know, kind of loose, kind of around there, but these are more final. These are my top five picks for sure. I love all five of these movies.
Yeah, these are definitely the ones that when I look back on this year, that I'm going to be like, that was like one of my favorite screenings. Like that definitely had some type of like lasting impact on me.
And I know Elric usually has this problem, but it was really hard for me to determine which order the five are
in. I've literally been rearranging them as I've been sitting here. I have arrows all over the
place
now.
My one and two are super. My number one is like, you know, solid. My number two is like solid. Those two were like super mm-hmm. easy. After that, it's a little random 3 to 5. Not even sure I love five yet, but it definitely deserves to be on this list.
Oh, then maybe you and I have the same number five.
That would be interesting. Would you like to go on a trip together?
I think it's to Sweden.
I would love to go to Sweden as long as it never gets dark.
Is our number five Midsommar?
We should stay together.
We should. All right.
Dreamweaver. Okay. So our number five.
Wow, me and collectively, Elric, Midsommar.
And I got to say, at one point, this was around the 10 mark for me.
Wow.
And then I thought about it and I was like, nah, but on sheer, like in terms of swings, this was to me the second biggest swing of the year. Like just of somebody who, after the second film, just doing something very bold, very different. The horror doesn't always work for me. And having seen Wicker Man, it feels like a lot of things are familiar. But my God, I thought the first 20 odd minutes was maybe my favorite 20 minutes of any movie this year in terms of just like, dude, that is such great storytelling.
And that's my thing too, is I think it starts out so strong. Now, I haven't watched yet, but I bought the director's cut from the UK because the UK disc is the longer version of it.
Right.
I do want to revisit that because to me, my feeling was that I only saw it the one time.
Yeah, me too.
So it was a very, very potent experience, but I remember loving maybe the first 45, 50 minutes of it and thinking, this is a masterpiece. And then the last hour of it, I was like, oh, I wish this just ended a little sooner and it would still be a masterpiece, but it's not. But there was enough in it, especially in terms of technique, filmmaking language and stuff. And also, it's such a dense, it's a very hefty meal. You know, there's a lot of things that are like, I knew after the main opening scene, when you see, I think, what is it, the wall or the quilt or whatever, I knew that everything we were seeing on that has some significance to what we're probably about to see. And I was slightly overwhelmed right away. I was like, oh no. And again, I think I said this when I initially saw it, and I'm going to choose my words carefully because people interpret things the way they want. But my friend's 18-year-old son went to see it and loved it. And he's been brought up on a steady diet of Kubrick and Hitchcock and all the classics. So he's a real film buff. And he just said, he walked out of the movie, he's like, I feel like this is my Kubrick. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm watching my Kubrick. And I'm not saying that Ari Aster is Kubrick by any means or anything. Mm. What I'm saying is that certain filmmakers have such a stamp right away that it's almost too much for you to handle. I mean, well, I just watched Eyes Wide Shut for the first time in 20 years, and it's the same deal. It's like, all right, Kubrick is one of those filmmakers that no matter what you feel about that movie, there is something to revisit there.
And you're not watching, you're never watching compromise.
Exactly.
You're watching like somebody who made something the way they, I mean, there is always compromise, but really it feels like you're never watching something that was rushed in any way or any way deviated from what that person was trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And that's what's so impressive. The most impressive thing about Midsommar is when you start hearing how much of a clusterfuck of a shoot it was in terms of the weather. Like it's, you watch this movie, it just seems kind of perfect and the weather looks perfect.
Yeah.
And then behind the scenes, I heard it's an utter nightmare.
Ari thought, he was like, oh, I'm going to shoot something in the daylight, which is absolutely perfect. And it turned out to be a nightmare.
Yeah, they're in Hungary or somewhere like
that.
Wow. But he, you know, he keeps making jokes that he's crying in the corner half the movie. But it does, yeah, and like it's another one that I have to watch again before I know how I feel about it. But
same.
Just in pure, in terms of just like, look, that's a major movie. That person was going for something really big. They were pouring their heart into it. They're pouring their relationships, their loss, everything. You see it. And what's cool, it's rare to see a film where you can identify with both parties, and I found myself doing that. So usually just go, oh, the guy's an asshole, the girl's great. And I found myself going, oh, I kind of understand what he's like in this part. Oh, yeah, I know what she's going through here.
Yeah.
And so it's a little, you know, it's an interesting.
Yeah, almost from that first conversation, you know these are two people that should not be together anymore.
Yeah.
And you might have been in that position once where you're like, oh, yeah, I know exactly that stage of a relationship.
And the guys, I mean, he's really, I mean, I think some of the scenes early on where it's like he really doesn't want his girlfriend to go with him on this trip, and the way he just caves and the way the guys look at him, you're just like, I have known so many people in that situation at some point of their lives in their 20s. I think it's surprisingly funny. And I think why it's less effective as a horror film to some people like us who are watching it really for horror is because it doesn't care about surprise at all.
Yeah.
So it's literally going, this is what's about to happen, and then it shows you what happens. And obviously that's a very easy thing to change if he wanted. So in the same way as The Lighthouse, it's like, oh, you're watching these people know how to control a scene, and they chose to take it in a different direction, which is a little less satisfying as a horror fan, but also, you know, still kind of mesmerizing. So
yeah,
I like it.
Well, cool. Number five for me and Ellie.
Nice. Well orchestrated.
Wow.
Well done, gentlemen.
Thanks, Ryan.
Number five for me is One Cut of the Dead.
Yes!
Nice.
This is probably the biggest surprise of the year for me. When it was given to me, it came with no context whatsoever. And I did like a quick look online and could only find these articles from overseas that were a little bit about it. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, cool, another zombie movie, yawn. And I put it on, and yes, it is a zombie movie.
It's just a straight zombie movie, and that's all that happens, and we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
And it's really a bad zombie film.
It's a terrible zombie
movie. It's just surprisingly
movie.
Highly placed
very
in your 10
uninventive.
So keep watching.
But no, this movie doesn't reinvent the zombie movie. What it does is it reinvents movies about the making of movies.
Yep.
And that was the real surprise for me. I mean, like, it is so incredibly charming, and then at the same time, it's just got this heartfelt kind of pulse behind it where that pays off in the end. And it's just beautifully, beautifully done. Incredibly witty, very funny, well written, well performed. I fucking love the movie. It's great.
And Rob G
and his fiance were the couple in the movie.
Oh. We were.
It's very sweet.
And
it's
I loved
cute.
That the girl who played the wife.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She saw our tweet and was very flattered.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
oh,
she saw
all this.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
cool.
Great.
That
was really
yeah, yeah, it warms
good.
My heart.
Wow. That's good. It's a pretty good zombie
movie. Very cool.
Moving on.
My number five is Atlantix.
Oh, yeah. So that's going to come up higher for me, but we can.
Okay. So this one I just watched last week, and I was honestly skeptical for the first hour of it.
I sold you pretty hard.
Yeah, you did. You were like, no, you have to stick with it. And I was really skeptical of it for the first hour. But it's very much, it's structured kind of similarly to Tigers Are Not Afraid, where we are set up with this social situation, this problem that is existing and how these people are surviving within it. And then the horror kind of creeps into it from there. And I ended up loving this film, by far one of my favorites of the year, so much that it made my top five. The whole setup of it is that it's set in Dakar, which is the capital city of Senegal.
Yeah, it's
It's apparently just this really hard city where there is, and I mean, we think we have this in the States, but the disparity between the upper class and the lower class is so vast. So you either live on pennies where you're struggling to find food, or you are incredibly wealthy. And in it, there's a group of workers who are struggling to get paid after they have built this kind of mast tower by the sea, and one of them falls in love with this girl who is about to ascend in social class. She has been arranged marriage with one of the wealthier men in town, but she doesn't love this guy that she's arranged to marry, even though that he gives her a phone, which is like this big deal of like, oh my gosh, he's given her this massive expensive gift. She's in love with the construction workers, and after they fight to get paid and can't, they decide to take a boat to sea to go to Spain. And you know almost instantly that it's grim. And then so the horror kind of comes out of
so
that.
So that's like, yeah, say almost,
that's all like in the first
like
10 minutes.
That's like 30 to 40
yeah.
minutes of just social realism, basically, yeah. Where you could totally not believe it's at all genre. And then, you know, I'll talk about it. I won't go much deeper later because I want people to see it. But this is actually one of my favorite movies of the year, period. Mm-hmm. Not horror or otherwise. But it's actually Film Comment just put out their top 20 films of the year. It's number three.
Really?
Film Comment, yeah.
Wow.
So this won a couple of major awards at Cannes.
It was also nominated, was one of the entries for the Academy Awards.
Yeah, for this good. But it's an actress directed this who was in a Claire Denis film a few years ago, and then this is her first feature, and it's so assured. She's half French and half her father was I think from Senegal, and her mother was native French, and so she kind of grew up in the film biz. Her uncle was a filmmaker, and this film's it's just so assured, but it's also the thing it reminded me of because we're talking about is it hard? Yeah, of course it's got hard. Iconography.
Yes.
It's not there to scare you at any point.
No, but there are no jump scares. No, there's a couple, we'll call them chilling moments, but it's very much like Tigers Are Not Afraid, where it's this social commentary with horror infused in it to kind of push it further.
This one, whatever reason, because Tigers Are Not Afraid is also a great movie, but this one spoke to me more, and I agree with you, they're very cut from the exact same cloth, but this one just got me more. This one, in terms of the imagery, the movies I'd put out there for you, the ones I really walked away with, I kept thinking about I Walked with the Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
By Val Luden and Jacques Tenier. It's just got certain images that look almost the same. A figure walking through the night with white eyes.
White eyes.
But in this, it's a djinn myth, and basically the idea is a dead person can possess their lover, and so that I won't go beyond that, but it's also a love story, and it's got a couple visual gags that are really clever,
and I think that's why it's missing a lot of horror top 10 lists, is even looking at Wikipedia and IMDb, they call it a romantic drama.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a horror film from the posters at all, but trust us, this is if you've got patience with some of these other titles, I do think it'll pay off. It's definitely high on this. I only started 2 weeks ago, you only started this week, so
I saw it two nights ago. Yeah,
but this is why you have to listening to shows. I know people listen to this. I listened to a bunch of podcasts. This one came up on a film comment. Somebody talked about the spooky stuff, and I was like, ooh, got to watch that. So,
but then after I started researching it, I found all these articles that were the best film of 2019 no one's talking about.
And this came out on Netflix, I think, the same time as Irishman. So I think they might have been within a couple days of each other. So it's to me, Netflix killing. It's that, and then I haven't seen Marriage Story, but these big movies that they're just dropping. So
that is Atlantics.
Your number,
That was my number five.
Number five. So number four, and it ties in perfectly, is Tigers Are Not Afraid for me.
Nice.
Again, this has been on the festival circuit for quite a bit, but it premiered on Shudder this year, and I think a lot of people got to see it that way. It's a Spanish film written and directed by
Isa Lopez.
The first half of it, as you're watching, you probably won't even recognize it as a horror film, but then there are elements that kind of tie in. And by the end of it, it makes total sense that she's now working on a project with Guillermo del Toro. Oh, really, yeah. It absolutely reminds me of things like Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, that kind of seeing the evils of the world through a child's eyes.
It's fairy tale aesthetic.
Yeah, and then
beautiful.
And then, but the fairy tale, but seeing the harsh reality of life. And sometimes bad things happen to kids in real life, which is,
especially in countries going through stuff like that.
Which to me is really scary, and hence there's the horror movie. Yeah. I don't know what else to say. It's beautifully directed, and it makes her – she did a few films before that, if I'm not mistaken, but nothing that touched the genre like this. So now I'm even more excited to see what she does next, which I think is supposed to be a werewolf movie or something like that.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to try to get her on. In the new year. We tried before, but I watched it last night again. The reason wasn't why I hadn't seen a year and three quarters
you watched
ago.
Quite a while ago.
I just wanted to see it to remember the horror element of it. And I'll tell you one thing, the actual horror parts where they actually show the mom who's kind of haunting her, but towards the end, you see these things, all I'll say is wrapped in plastic. I find it utterly haunting. It's exactly the kind of horror I love, those kind of images. It was really good to see it again. It's a great film, and I'm glad it's one of the best rated and best reviewed films of the last couple of years.
This was, I think it was number three on my list last year, and which was definitely an argument because it had not technically come out, although it had played everywhere in
Let Your Freak Fly.
This is the year that
I know this is the year that everybody
Shudder.
Gets to see it. Yeah. So,
and that's actually when we tried to bring her on was when it was to coincide with
Shudder. Yeah, but we'll get it eventually. I loved this film. So I remember bawling my eyes out the first time I saw it.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's rare. It's rare that a film, a horror or a genre
I'm not
film.
Laughing at you crying. It's a,
why you gotta laugh at me crying, Ryan?
I hate feeling things.
Ah, there it is.
Man,
I saw this movie quite a bit ago, and in the Blumhouse screening room, and I came out little wet-eyed.
Hits the feels, yeah.
Aww. Hits the feels, hits yeah. It didn't make my list. I didn't make my list. I think it's beautifully made. But again, just based on my criteria of like what I would, you know, kind of rewatch and all that stuff, it's just, it's very, very heartfelt and it punches you in the gut and it's beautifully made and, you know, it got me.
Wow.
I don't like to admit that.
Oh, I'm all sad again.
I know.
All right.
Also, it's a really cute, like, animated bear thing.
Yeah.
Animatronic bear thing that wrote. Or tiger.
You're number four, Elric.
You know what's exciting? I have no idea what it's going to be.
You don't even know.
So I've seen my number five. Okay. It's a biggie. Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep.
Ooh. Nice.
In the number four spot, sometimes it's hard doing these top tens when you've just seen these movies. I mean, these are brand new, in the last few weeks movies. But I got to say, the scale of this thing, I still don't like it as much as I think Haunting of Hill House is his masterpiece. I think it's I just utterly love that series. I think it was so well done.
I'm eyeing that Blu-ray set because apparently it's different versions of the episodes. It's like uncut director's cuts versions.
Interesting. Yeah, I need
if
to
I
that.
Revisit the show, I want to watch this alternate version.
It's also
version.
Hard to get things from Netflix that are in physical media. But this film has stayed with me. I mean, I especially loved all the new stuff that was like I love his recreations. The Shining stuff is super impressive. But my God, the what's her name? Jane Hat Jane a Hat.
What's that? Oh, Rose the Hat. I'll jump that in here because it's my number four as well.
Okay, cool. Take it away.
Dr. Sleep is my number four as well. Yeah. So yeah, I was so impressed with this. And I have to say, I liked the stuff that wasn't at the Overlook more than when they got to the Overlook and it became Shining Part 2. Yeah. Like, I loved the new stuff. That was kind of horror perfection.
Some of the imagery of
them like floating above the earth. Like, there was just so much of, and even when they were exploring the mines, like so much of it was like these cerebral concepts and seeing how Mike kind of chose to visualize that and portray it and kind of, embody the idea of floating or transporting your brain somewhere else or being outside of a scenario watching it, and the idea of like how he envisioned that and was able to capture it visually as a filmmaker. I was so impressed with that.
And just as a cult movie, like I love watching this group as a cult, thinking about that. I think it's so effective. I think even if it didn't have any of the others, that story would be to me pretty scary. Has probably one of the, well, I would say maybe unequivocally the scariest, most disturbing scene of the year. And to think that exists in a mainstream movie compared to some indie film is kind of hard to believe.
Yep.
But it pays off. It's not just gratuitous anyway, and it's a very emotional movie, which I appreciated. It's a movie I'm really looking forward to seeing a second time. Out of all these movies, it's one of the ones I'm most looking forward to seeing another time before kind of totally grappling with it. But kudos to him for taking, again, another big swing.
Yeah.
That is number four for us.
Number four. Well, let me roll up my proverbial paper over here. Oh, crinkle, okay. crinkle. Elric. My number four is another show, Chernobyl.
Wow. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, I will say that is by far the most fucked up show I saw this year.
It's a real world horror story.
Presented
in a way that I think would make horror filmmakers envious.
It's true.
It is. It's
how many episodes was it?
Six. It was not long.
Five or something. Yeah. It wasn't long.
I remember I watched that on a treadmill before I had to go to class. And then I remember thinking, I can't go to class now. Like it was so intense. Yeah. It was, and I wasn't expecting it. It kind of snuck up on you.
I mean, Craig Mazin is no joke, and his HBO series is a nail biter in every sense. It's just like one of the most harrowing stories I've seen this year, where you're just on the edge of your seats through, it can be incredibly talky at times, but I'm going to butcher her name, but the woman who did the score for it, her name is Hilder. I think she also did the Joker soundtrack as well, but that score is it just creeps under your skin and it just sits there. And it's constantly reminding you that there's a fucking disaster happening in this area, and no one can stop it. Mm. Like, it's just going on for months.
And I imagine five episodes.
For our generation, it's probably cool because we like are a little after Chernobyl, where we know what it is, but don't probably know anything about how it kind of came to be.
That was the thing. I mean, I was in elementary school when Chernobyl blew, and what I remembered was there was a major disaster. It happened in another country. Happened in a country that we weren't exactly friendly with.
Yeah.
And would that danger creep over to the United States?
Right.
And then And then it just kind of crept. And then like anything else, when you're like a 10-year-old, it just kind of seeps away and that fear goes away. And you really don't revisit, well, what was the rest of the story? Mm-hmm. And this series is here to go, here's the rest of the story. It's even worse than you thought, you know, and you know, the makeup effects are absolutely incredibly brutal.
Oh my God, it's gruesome. I mean,
people who are from radiation poisoning, the heroism that, you know, many of the Russians, you know, pulled off to try to stop it from happening, you know, the miners who were involved and, you know, some of the political players that were involved that were really trying to step up and dealing with a lot of bullshit political stuff themselves, who were trying to stop communication, you know, letting other, you know, cities know that there is a radiation outbreak.
And Jared Harris is in this, right?
Yeah, Jared Harris. You know, it kind of takes like the Hunt for Red October approach to things, where it's just like, yeah, they're Russians, but they're going to speak with British accents. And you know what? You kind of dismiss that pretty early on. But I mean, like some of these performances are heartbreaking because you're basically watching men who know immediately that they're going to die in the immediate future. They just don't know when. And it depends on the level of radiation poisoning that they get. Yeah. I mean, it is, a complete surprise to me. I mean, HBO has really knocked the park this year. I mean, I'm in the midst of Watchmen, and my God,
that's
Watchmen
what I'm hearing,
is
man. I've heard
fucking
from everyone,
brilliant.
Yeah.
And Righteous Gemstones, you know, just throw a shout out to my colleagues. I mean, like, that show is hilarious. HBO is just killing it. But anyways, Chernobyl is my number four because I truly saw that as a horror series.
And to tie that all in, so Craig Mason, who did that show, I haven't watched Chernobyl yet because it just seems like a very dark...
It's a little bleak.
It's a little bleak week to get into. But he did a podcast for that. And more importantly, he is doing a podcast right now for Watchmen, where he interviews Damon Lindelof. And it's great.
Ooh.
So the showrunner of Chernobyl interviewing the showrunner of Watchmen about Watchmen.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Amazing.
It's called the Watchmen Official Podcast. Okay. But it is... Yeah, I know that's genre adjacent, but man, do I love this new watch.
Yeah,
like, I never thought they could make a sequel to that comic and it be almost better than, like, it's incredible how good it is. And there's one more to go.
Interesting. Well, Mazin does his own podcast, Script Notes, with John Armstrong.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to add the Watchmen one. Right? No.
And you guys will know Chernobyl as the shooting location of Return of the Living Dead 4 and 5.
Really?
Do you remember that when that was announced? And you were like, why are you guys? By Ellery Elklum, the New Zealander who made Eight-Legged Freaks. That's the only reason I know it.
Yep.
It's because I was following his career at the time, and I was like, why is he going to Chernobyl to make movies? That does not sound like a good idea.
That was a move.
Yeah. Remember Chernobyl? No, Chernobyl Diaries?
I do.
Post-paranormal activity. One of those.
That'll be a different episode. Our favorite Chernobyl movie. Sure.
All right.
So, okay, guys. I think we're on to three.
Number three. Okay, so number three is for me. So basically, my top three are all my top, could be my number one. It's really hard. I loved all three of these movies equally, but like you'll see why some outweigh others. But my number three is...
Wait, I'm going to ask you before you say it, should we do this differently if we all have the same one? Should we just like, if your number three is the same as my number one, should we just talk about them here?
I think
we got to preserve our number
one. Top three, you get your 15 minutes.
Got
whatever.
It. Got
Elric just like waved a hand at Rob.
He's like, I want to be able to talk about this.
That was an intense moment.
All right, number three
is Us, Jordan Peele's new movie. Yeah, it was, I've only seen it once. I saw it that one time in theaters. I own it and I don't know. It's just that first experience was so potent because, of course, we didn't know what Get Out was going to be. Like, came out of kind of nowhere in terms – even what little previews we saw, we really weren't prepared for exactly what kind of a voice he would be as a horror filmmaker. And so that exceeded expectations, and I loved that movie. So you're kind of like, all right, what's the sophomore movie going to be? Where is he going to take this? I know it's going to be unexpected because I didn't expect Get Out. And just right away from that really great theme that it's not exactly like it, but it evokes like the theme of The Omen sort of. It's just got that off kilter, the, you know, duh, duh,
you know, and you were seeing the pigeons and stuff like that. You're like, where is this going to go? And I found the opening to be really scary. And it's just, it was a movie that only on a very loose scale I knew was probably something to do with doppelgangers. And it just went in really cool, interesting directions. There was a lot of, it was a great audience movie. A lot of laughs. There was a lot of scares. There was a lot of interesting things going on, a lot of interesting ideas. And what I love about this movie is, you know, Get Out might be the better movie in terms of, you know, from start to finish, just a straightforward movie. I think this is the better made movie. Mm. And it reminds me in the same way that, you know, Wes Craven was an idea guy. Like, he always went really big with kind of the density of what he was trying to say, like, you know, his stories. I feel like Jordan's got a lot to say, and there's a lot of stuff in there that, again, is going to make it more satisfying to revisit, because I know that there's little, I don't want to call them Easter eggs, but I know that there's things there to be rediscovered. Right. So, yeah, I mean, call it whatever you want. It's a Twilight Zone. It's a Black Mirror. It's just a really great horror movie, and I can't wait to see what he does next. Like, I'm on board for whatever he does theatrically.
My favorite dad of the year. I just love the dad.
He's
makes
great.
Me really laugh in that movie, especially the speedboat stuff. There's just something funny about it.
Yeah,
when he's battling himself.
And it was, you know, for a while there, it was probably going to be my number one. In fact, when I went to Halloween Horror Nights this year, there's something so fun about that maze, because it really did capture the vibe of that whole thing. And, you know, you have a bunch of people jumping out of mirrors and doing that whole thing.
I didn't
get
to this year.
It was pretty great. And then even better on YouTube, there's a little YouTube clip of Lupita. She decided to be one of the girls in the maze.
Oh, that's fun.
So you can imagine walking into a room and be like, wow, wait, that really looks like her. And it was her.
She was just nominated for something that people started saying that this could actually put her in the real conversation this year, which is kind of cool. You know, again, like another crossover horror after Tony Klitz and all of last year.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was. Okay, cool. Good choice. That's a good movie. My number three, we don't even have to talk about it. I just talked about it. That is Maddie Diop's Atlantics at number three. That's how highly I thought of this interesting film.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've never heard of this fucking movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, it probably is. I don't think it's being marketed as a horror
film. It's not. It's a romantic drama, but it's totally a horror
film.
But
it is. I mean, the last half of it
so
is.
So wild. And it's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix.
Yep. All right, I'm going to check it out. My number three is Peter Strickland's In Fabric.
Oh,
nice.
This could have been almost my number one, but it's not even on my list because I watched it 2 years ago at the AFI. I totally forgot about it. Yeah. I love this movie.
Finally, out
this
world.
One, yeah, I watched the screening link of so this weird. Like 6 months ago. Has it had a wide release yet?
Just came
out. I saw this like at the beginning of the year or something like that. And it is my level of bananas.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. This is a fun one.
Like when they go, hey, Ryan, what's the ingredients for a bananas movie that you love? And I go, you know what? In Fabric, which is a movie about a haunted dress that fucks people up. And not only do you have the haunted dress, but you have the department store in which the dress was sold and the proprietors of said department store.
Who feel
store.
Like Edward Vig, you know, Giallo actresses.
Where, yeah, Giallo actresses led by a weird old man who loves to ejaculate on clothes. Yeah. But I love the score. I'm waiting for the score to come out.
Yeah.
Because the score is so memorable. But it's just definitely one of those it's not perfect because I feel like some story I think I feel like some story like kind of overrides the other because it's a little bit anthological.
I wish it almost had been up front saying it's an anthology about the thing instead of because the first story you really start to feel and it's treated like a straight drama.
You're actually in it.
You're emotionally in that story. And then when it changes, it becomes the middle one's like super goofy.
Yeah.
And it becomes broadcast. It's actually the guys from some of the Number Nine, some of those British shows that you watch are suddenly in it. And you're like, oh, that the two bosses. I mean, that stuff.
That
is,
sounded like very.
Some of the shows
some
that
of
you watch.
British shows you watch. No,
let me just say right now, some of the ones she just showed me in a class recently are some of the best things I've seen this year. They're hilarious. The one they shared recently.
I saw you cry. I saw you cry at one.
Well, you didn't see tears, but it was very emotional. No, I'm with you. This will definitely be on my Pure Cinema list because I forgot about this because I love this movie. But this is the hard part when you see something a couple of years ago and then the release.
I know.
Came out in England like literally 2 years ago and was a big movie there.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like the tone is so weird because it's not really, again, doesn't really want to be a horror film. First half is, second half's comedy. Then there's these weird
things. I love
things.
It. I love those tonal shifts. I feel like it's the first movie of his that I truly love.
Yeah.
Because Barbarian Sound Studio like isolated me so so much.
I appreciated that, but I could never fully engage and get into it.
I love the movie that's in the movie.
Yeah,
like,
that's it.
You know, I love the movie that they're making in the movie, and I wish there was more of that. And I have the
but the movie he made after that's super kinky with the two women.
Duchess of Burgundy. Duchess of Burgundy. Yeah, it wasn't my thing either.
But beautiful. They're all beautiful, but this is the first one that like you're just like, wow, this is totally original.
Yeah, and here's the thing about Strickland. Like, there is some magic, there's kernel of magic in each of his movies that keeps me coming back.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, even though I did not like those last two movies, I was like, I wonder what he's up to with the Zen Fabric movie.
His first film, and no one's seen here because I guess it still doesn't have a good release. It's called Caitlin Varga, and it's a literal rape revenge movie. It's set in Transylvania, but it's not grisly. It's actually really great. Like, it's one of the best, like, the female character who is like, kind of decides to get revenge. She's had this kid out of, after the attack, you assume.
Right.
And then she sees these people and just goes after them. It's shot like an art film, not like a horror film at all. Huh. And so it definitely announces this guy, like, who is this English guy making films in Transylvania?
Yeah.
Like, cause he's British, but he lives in Romania. He still lives in Romania. You're just really? Like, what a weird kind of background. But, you know, he's become a pretty big deal in England. He's become like one of their – it's almost like a new Ken Russell in a sense. He's making that kind of out there cinema.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know what's next, but yeah, I'm with you. And Fabric rocks. Yeah.
Yep. Becca.
Okay, so my number three is Crawl. I ended up seeing this twice. I loved this so much. It was just a fun theatrical screening. I mean, I'm glad that there's some subtext of like father-daughter relationships and all that stuff. I was not as concerned with that as I was giant alligators up on screen and a dog and, a hurricane.
These movies still exist.
Yeah. I love that it's just like, you know, it's an animal attacks movie and that we can just have giant alligators taking people out for the fuck of
it. Isn't it crazy that we could do literally an all-nighter of alligator attack movies,
right?
Now? I mean, there are that many good
it's
alligators.
Awesome. And I mean, this definitely, there was a very small subgenre that emerged in the 2000s where we had like Rogue and Blackwater and Lake Placid, and that was 90s, I think 99 on Lake Placid. But I remember Rogue and Blackwater coming out back to back and I just being like, yes. And it was right when they were doing all those Maneater series, and there was a couple alligator ones out of that Genius Products was doing at the time. And I'm just so glad we still get killer alligators and that this did not feel so far from real. Like, I lose it when I'm watching the sci-fi ones and they're like, well, they're alligators, but they're also boa constrictors and they got some alien DNA in there as well. And those definitely make me step out. But the fact that everything in this was semi-plausible, okay, except for that shower door, but and the fact that she was tearing up the kitchen floor with her bare hands, what the fuck? But the majority of the movie was semi-plausible, at least rooted somewhere in truth. I was kind of like, I was so into it. It had amazing jump scares. There was just some really, really well orchestrated jump scares throughout.
Yay, Crawl.
Yay.
All right, we're up to number two. My number two is One Cut of the Dead,
nice.
Which Ryan already talked about. I mean, look, I dressed up as the character from this movie. To me, what really stuck to me is, well, yes, the filmmaking technique, the fact that the first 30 minutes is a one-take movie, and then the fact that the third act is all payoff for everything you just watched. I love movies about making movies, misfits trying to make movies. I kept saying this is the Bowfinger of horror because I freaking love Bowfinger.
Yeah,
and I think that's the best analogy you can come up with, because when you see the movie at the end of Bowfinger or snippets of it, you're like, oh, look at that. Like, that actually worked. Got you, sucker.
Yeah.
And ironically enough, Dolmite Is My Name is also a similar misfits making a movie movie. Mm-hmm. But One Cut of the Dead, I mean, it just hits all my boxes. I think it's really funny and has its heart in the right place. And I just love the story of it, the story of the movie, that it's this little independent Japanese movie that somehow made back like 2,500 times its budget at the box office in Japan and became a huge hit. So even the people that made this movie are the underdogs that are represented in it.
But should it be on a horror list? Is it really a horror
You know what? And that actually was what I debated about with my number one, because there's – you know what? For me it is, because there is a horror movie within it, even if you get to see behind the
I guess it's hard to talk about.
That was my argument. There is a horror film there regardless. So, yeah. I mean, I really don't.
Is it for a general? I mean, I guess a general audience could. It's catered to a horror audience, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So it's a movie for us, even though I think a general audience could really appreciate it too. But
I think so too.
Yeah, I mean, I can't not put it. I mean, it's if it's a Halloween costume, it's a horror movie in my book. Right. That's how I look at
it. Well, despite taking umbrage with you placing it at your number two on this list, my number two is One Cut of the Dead, bitches.
Oh, man.
I fucking love this movie.
Are you serious? Yeah, what a freaking...
This is almost my favorite movie of the year, just generally. Wow. Like, this is top two movies of the whole year for me in general. I just think that there's no movie that gave me more joy than watching this on a plane and going, oh, yeah, it's okay. This is kind of fun. This is kind of fun. This is, to me, probably the greatest movie ever. The only time I am okay with people who have been live tweeting, which I'm totally against, has been when me and you have, like, when you've gone online and somebody's gone, oh, 15 minutes into this, guys, I think I'm going to stop. I'm almost done. And then you're like, then you just watch everyone go, no, no, you got to keep going. And I love that feeling. This just brought it all back for me. It was a forget all the movie, forget the story. The feeling I had when this ended is, yeah, this is why I've done everything I've done in my life. I want to make movies. I don't care if they're in my backyard with my friends. I'm going to make movies. And it was the spirit of when I did that on high 8 cameras and when I did on super 8 cameras, and it all came back. And so in that way, I like it even more than the Dolemite movie, because it feels that as I love the Dolemite movie for the comedy, but I didn't feel that those feelings. I didn't make that kind of movie.
Yeah.
I made these kind of things, like where you're for just like trying to pull it off, and we can't talk about it all without spoiling it. Mm-hmm. I love this film, and I have no problem with being a horror list. I was also fucking with Becca the other night by saying that, because it was all just a
point. Yeah, you were completely arguing, because I was like, he was quizzing me. He's like, so what are your top ones going to be? And I was like, I don't know, One Cut of the Dead will definitely be up there. And he was like, it's not even a horror film. And then we argued for like 20 minutes about it.
It was all a giant ploy.
She would put it, or that's so loud.
So lame.
Anyway. I actually, and again, you know, I appreciate that Shudder put this out and everybody can watch it, but I do recommend getting friends together. I shot a movie this summer called Lucky, and right before we shot it, I had the director come over, my buddy Scott Reynolds, and a whole group of us, mostly filmmakers, watch it, and they're all quiet for that first like half hour, and then once it starts kicking in, you could just sense the appreciation. There's a guy that's working on the film within a film that's basically like, you know, I can't drink this kind of water. Did you get my email?
Did you get my email? I sent
like,
an email.
The email thing is like, I don't know why, like, Natasha lost it at that. Because it's like, you know
filmmaking.
That. You know that
I
guy.
I sent the email.
I sent an email about this. I
like,
can't
that's how validates everything. So I sent the email.
There's some funny shit in there.
Yeah. And just the director is the best character.
He's great.
He's my favorite guy of the year.
He's
so good.
That's why I was him.
Well done on that. That was one of the best costumes. So, yes, One Cut of the Dead gets our universal praise here.
Ryan, number two.
My
number two is Ready or Not.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Oh, no, it was a genuine surprise for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, Radio Silence demonstrated they definitely have a lot of talent and a lot of ingenuity. I mean, the VHS short really knocked my socks off when they did that haunted house riff. Mm-hmm. And then Southbound, I thought there was some really cool imagery. Yeah. I kind of prefer them when they're not in front of the camera. I'd rather have them behind the camera. Sorry, fellas. But Ready or Not, you know, I thought those guys had a pretty bad luck with their first movie. You know, they did it over at Fox.
What was it?
Devil's Due is the pregnancy one.
Yeah. And I think that they were up against a lot.
I could be confusing those two.
Anyways, I feel like this was just them really being able to stretch their legs, have the creative freedom that they want. They needed to tell this story. You know, Samara Weaving, MVP. I mean, like, put her in every horror movie. I saw her in another movie this year that played at a festival called Guns Akimbo, which is fucking insane. Oh, yeah,
the guy made Deathgasm.
Yeah, the guy did Deathgasm. Yeah, and it's a bonkers movie.
Jason, he listens. What's up, man?
Yeah, what's up, dude?
I'd love to get him on. I love Deathgasm.
I'd love to get Deathgasm 2 going.
Yeah.
Actually, for some strange reason, I saw King Diamond recently at the Wiltern.
Did he sing Abigail?
Of course he did.
Oh, fuck yes.
And I was actually thinking of Jason Lee Howden for some reason. King Diamond. It'd be really cool if this guy I've actually never met and who loves metal would be here.
I want him to make an Abigail movie, because I have long said Abigail needs an Abigail movie.
Everybody does. We need
an Abigail movie.
But Ready or Not is just super slick, and it's got great fun characters that you fucking hate, and you're really rooting for Samara Weaving. It's just a very... I mean, like, and this isn't a knock against it, but it just felt like a animated movie come to life. Mm. There's something very cartoonish about Samara Weaving's feature. These big eyes, and she's a very beautiful girl, but she's got a lot of expression. And when you just see her, like, either sneering or shouting at somebody or screaming in terror, you just feel it. Like, mm-hmm. You just feel it at the back of the theater. And when she's up against, like, all of these other, also outlandish and cartoony villains, you know, you just root for him and you just go on this journey. And what I also love about it is it succeeds in doing a very unconventional ending.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, my God. I was not expecting
it falls.
The most radio silence part of the whole film.
Exactly.
That's where you see their hand.
Exactly.
You're like, that's very cool.
And you know what? And if that was a win for them, then awesome. Like, if they had to battle an exec to get that to happen, good for you guys.
Yeah.
but it also adds up. You know, I mean, like, narratively, it all makes sense. And even though I remember sitting in the theater, because I was in Wilmington at the time, and it was a pretty packed house for opening night out there. And when it happened, like, it took me to start laughing for everybody else to suddenly go, oh, this is funny. Supposed to be super fun, you know? And they all got in on it. But it's just a blast. It's instantly rewatchable. I can't wait to, like, kind of just kick back and watch it again.
Yeah, I really want to see it again.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I think it's going to be, of all our lists, it's going to be the most rewatched movie.
Absolutely.
I think it's the movie of this day, this year that's going to get seen by the most people over time.
Yeah, I mean, I almost feel like of the list, probably The Headhunter, Crawl, Shadows, and Ready or Not. And my number one.
Yeah.
You know, I can't wait to rewatch them.
Yeah.
My number two is one that I'm sure is not on any of your guys' lists. I don't even think any of you have seen it. And that is Little Monsters.
I saw Little Monsters.
I talked about it last week. Okay. Oh, wait. You did talk about it, Ryan. I did not know that you've seen it. Okay. Yeah. Ulrich, you're out.
I chose not to see it.
I had, and this is one where I questioned, it was like, should I put this on my list? Because it was polarizing. It was another one where some people were like, this is great. And other people hated it. Huh. And so it was one where I was like, why do I like it? And I just had so much fun with it. And I mean, I am not in a zombie mood right now across the board. Like, zombies are done for me. And then I look at the zombie films that came out this year, like Dead Don't Die and Zombieland 2, which both just made me go, meh.
Dead Don't Die is my number one, but we'll get there soon.
No, it is not. But both of those got so much more hype than Little Monsters. And both of them just made me go, and, like, they reinforced why I'm sick of zombies. And then Little Monsters did the opposite for me, because my top three all had heart and they all made me so excited to be a fan of the genre. So I had Crawl, Little Monsters, and then my number one. But Little Monsters, it was just fun. It had moments of tension, but Lupita was amazing.
Great, amazing
in this. Completely different role, completely different scenario. And it didn't get much attention. I mean, it just kind of, I remember there was
great
one
trailer,
day.
I remember
that. One of my friends just texted me one day and was like, hey, this is on Hulu and you'd probably like it. And I was like, I'd been waiting for months to see it at that point. I was shocked it didn't do a bigger theatrical here. I would love to know the story behind it, especially because the director, Abe Forsyth, is now doing the new RoboCop remake. Mm. So,
what a weird jump.
Yeah, right?
Wait, they just remade it, though.
No, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
They're doing a
sequel.
Neil
Blomkamp was going to do a...
What was the
sequel
RoboCop
to the original?
It was going to be a sequel to the original, and he's taken over.
Yeah, he's taken over.
Oh, so and this is a sequel. The other one was a remake, though.
And I mean, the movie, it's not without some problems, but it made me feel good. And it's one of those that at the end of the day, I was like, I just feel really good being a horror fan right now. Mm-hmm.
So. I wonder if it's just, and I'm not knocking them at all, but I wonder if it's a Hulu problem, because this is the same thing with Wounds, right? It's like Wounds has a good festival, attention. And then ends up on a platform that a lot of people have, but maybe not as many people as, say, a Netflix or an HBO or whatever.
And one that is not known for their theatrical movies or features. Like, you go to Hulu to watch TV.
Perhaps it could have benefited Hulu to have a horror podcast on there, a video show perhaps, pointing to titles that they could say are good horror titles. If only a dream.
We all felt that, Elric.
Watch like, last Halloween. How many Halloweens was it?
It's
not
even, two.
It's not even,
it's
on,
not
there
even on there anymore.
Oh, okay. We've been
canceled.
Okay. But we were on there once.
Hit me up and I'll send you the link to the Shockwaves episode of Hulu's Friday Night Lights.
But that said, Little
Better
Monsters.
To have a canceled pilot than no pilot. tell you that.
It wasn't a pilot. It did air as a show.
Okay, there you go.
Dirty Laundry, gentlemen.
No, I thought it was good.
Little Monsters. Kindergarten teacher takes a group of students on a field trip to a petting zoo on the same day as a zombie outbreak. It's a blast.
Okay, this is it. Number one.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. It's no surprise. In terms of everything I love about horror movies, mm. I got it all in Dr. Sleep.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've already been a huge fan of Mike Flanagan. I think what he's been doing in the last couple of years has been top notch. I don't think there's a single movie of his that I didn't love in some way. And I just love that he got to take this leap, you know? And it's interesting because people are going to theorize about, you know, the amount of money they spent versus how much it made at the box office and all that kind of stuff. But I, you know, much like the original Shining, which wasn't really well received when it first came out, I think this the tables are going to turn pretty fast on this movie, and it's going to be well regarded
oh, yeah.
pretty quickly.
Definitely,
probably as soon as it comes out on video, but or in VOD. I really do wish they just put it out the last week of October.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I just think this movie would have killed for Halloween.
I even was feeling burnout towards horror when that came out. Cause so much in October.
Yeah, the week and after, like yeah. when you're
whose fault is that?
Like it took me
them for releasing it after Halloween.
No, whose fault is for consuming so much horror during
that's
the month
us.
Of October?
But we're all horror.
Everybody.
Fans. What,
it's
you
been
don't
commercialized like
does,
Christmas.
So of course I do. I think
but,
you're right.
But no, I mean, I love it. I love it as a sequel to the Kubrick movie. I love it. I love all the original stuff much more. It does have one of what I – it's probably one of the most shocking, upsetting scenes in the last couple of years.
Oh, my God.
That I've seen in a movie.
It was hard to watch.
And you know what? It's not there for any sort of gratuitous reason. There's so much payoff. For it, that has to be there for you to really feel satisfied by everything that follows, and I did definitely. So I love it. It's in you know, and it's a. I think he gets King's material really beautifully, and I don't know anyone else that could have pulled off this King Kubrick hybrid, and done it as well. So
also one of my favorite. I mean, I've got a few favorite. People imitating Shelley Duvall performances, but that is top three.
Alex Esso, bless you.
She was so good.
It's what's so good about it is she looks exactly like her, acts just like her, and yet suddenly feels totally uniquely her own.
Yeah.
It's really, truly, that's the most impressive thing I've seen.
She does. Year. She does the Shelley Duvall run in
Danny. The run is
like,
so good.
So perfect. Yeah. It's great. No, it's my number one. I'm beyond excited for anything Mike does going forward, including the new season of Hill House.
That one will probably go up all our lists in time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Cool. Number one, Elric.
So I guess people kind of getting sense. So Bill Murray is a small town sheriff.
Shut up.
Tom Waits.
Oh, dear Lord.
I'm going to just stick with this now.
Iggy Pop
both of you.
Loves coffee.
This film, if you watch it in black and white, is okay. You got to watch this film in black and white.
Oh, God.
My number one deserves its own list. It's so much higher than every other film on this list for me, even though not every single scene worked. Split by diopter aside, I think Us is such a great swing, mm-hmm. such a great movie. I think about it quite – I've only still seen it the one time in theaters, and yet even afterwards we had so many questions. We're walking and talking, but then it just stays with you, and then you think about it, and you just go, man, the craft of this movie for what we want horror films to be, this is our – this to me is our John Carpenter that we're getting to witness, who's going to hopefully have a run of films the way Carpenter yep. did, all exploring different things. I think this is just an utter home run of a movie. I wish there was a little less exposition towards the end, but who cares? After a while, it's like whatever. Let it – you know what I mean? There's so much to this. I love the stuff with Elizabeth Moss. I love the stuff when they break into the house. I think that sequence is some of the funniest and scariest stuff of the year. I just think that whole sequence is brilliant with the young girl twins and just the performances. The little girl at the start of this film, I think her performance walking into the maze is incredible. I think what Lupita is doing on the beach when you're just trying to get to know her and you're starting to kind of understand what the actual story is. You're getting these clues to what the reveals are going to be without ruining it. I think this movie has gotten better and better in my brain.
And we haven't talked enough about Lupita's performance as the doppelganger.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
The voice, the body language.
Well, and without spoilers, it's so complex.
Yeah.
Like once
yeah.
you start thinking about performance, this is like why Tony Collette did this amazing performance. And then you watch this one and go, oh, and this is, you know, as good because she's playing multiple sides to characters that the coin is spinning. You can't tell necessarily which is which side of the coin. I love that about it.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
This movie's modern masterpiece.
My number one I also call a modern masterpiece, and that is Dr. Sleep.
Wow.
I feel bad because I wanted to see it again, and like almost instantly. And I had not felt that way about a film in a very long time. I mean, it is probably one of the most compelling viewings I've had in a long time. And it's just because my heart belongs to Stephen King, and Mike Flanagan knows how to tell a great story, and he's a great filmmaker. And, you know, I was listening to the score by the Newton Brothers over the weekend, you know, just kind of get freshened up by the score, and the score just lends so much character to it. And Ewan McGregor, I mean, like I enthused about it many weeks ago when it came out, but it's just, you know, it's just one of those films that stuck with me. And I think all of these great puzzle pieces came together, and Mike overcame a lot of challenges in terms of trying to adapt it, because it's not easy. You know? I mean, he's gone on many podcasts talking about, you know, like, how do you keep Stephen King happy, and how do you, you know, stay true to what Stanley Kubrick is? Because, I mean, like, I remember really early on when Dr. Sleep was announced, and I was like, how the fuck do you do this? And because, I mean, the movie, Stanley Kubrick's movie, if you like, it's much like Pennywise, dude. I mean, like, when you say The Shining to someone on the street, they go, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Or they'll go, Jack Nicholson peering through the door. And, exactly. You know, the Overlook Hotel
Red carpet Rum.
And all that. Red Rum. All, I mean, like, oh, they think that Stanley Kubrick's film is canon when, you know, there's this really great book out there that has a different chain of events and has different history to it. And Mike just blended it all so well and so seamlessly. It's amazing. I think I cannot stop talking about the movie whenever I run into people who are like, I still haven't seen Dr. Sleep yet, you know.
Yeah, so I do good. The same thing anytime. I'm always like, you have to see it.
Yeah.
You know.
So good.
Yeah.
Great.
My number one is One Cut of the Dead.
Wow.
That was, and I mentioned that my top three.
Yeah,
that my top three were all based on kind of heart. And this for me was my heart movie of the year. It reminded me why I'm here. I cried at the end. Yeah. Like, I was tearing up in that final moment. It was everything that I love about filmmaking. It was everything that I love about set. It was everything that I love about art in general, because it's that camaraderie where everyone feels this project that just has to be done at any cost, and kind of preserving the artifice of it. And it was just, and at the same time, kind of seeing his filmmaker and his love for filmmaking, infusing it in his daughter, and finding his passion of filmmaking through this project, because it was all of an exploration about how he'd been doing these things that were quick and efficient, and that was like his whole MO, and then finding something that wasn't, but finding his passion within it. It was a beautiful movie. So. Oh,
and then to think that this tiny little movie that looks like nothing, I mean, it really isn't a great looking movie, and that doesn't need to be, to think it found this audience, like in its own country, made a huge amount of money on nothing budget. It's kind of like Evil Dead style, which is freaking the whole dream of horror for horror filmmakers, is that one little little niche that it can still come from anywhere. If you're out there dreaming of this, this is Francis Ford Coppola's thing, where the next great masterpiece could be made by some, you know, a little girl in Iowa or whatever his quote was, you know, 30 years ago. And it's very true now that the cameras have caught up. It's a democratic art form, and you can do it.
Yeah. As soon as I saw this, I called it the lights out of horror, noises off of horror, which I don't know if you guys have seen Noises Off. So you need to see Noises Off, but because it is the same thing in kind of a theatrical setting. But it's just the behind the curtain. And at the same time, I have showed this now to 4 film classes since I first saw it. And I have not done that for any other film, where I'm just like, it's like a love letter. It will explain to you why you are here.
Yeah.
So I love it. One Cut of the Dead.
I'm so happy. That was on everyone's list? Was that
Yeah. So it was Dr. Sleep.
That one was truly Shockwaves approved. I'll be honest, a little surprised how uniform we are in certain titles, but it's really cool that one and Dr. Sleep make it. But I'm a little surprised on a couple others, but hey.
Yeah, well, I think that some made my, like Us was vying for my top 10. I actually had it down as my top 10 and ended up crossing it off and putting in Velvet Buzzsaw, because I was thinking like purely like, what did I personally enjoy? Like, what did I have the most fun with? I was scared while watching Us, but I had a fucking blast with Velvet Buzzsaw. So Us is definitely the better movie. like a hundredfold, but yeah, it was more of a personal choice.
Speaking of Stephen King, you know what? I thought when I saw it, it would definitely make this list around the 9 or 10. I thought Pet Sematary was going to be there for me. I know a lot of people, you know, online, this was not necessarily popular, but I had just the way I saw it pretty early, you know, I really enjoyed that film in the theater, and it was just a very different experience than the last movie.
And you knew nothing about it, though.
I knew nothing, and
you
had
that advantage.
And I liked the original, but I loved that they didn't just give me the same movie, and I thought they had a couple actually really creepy things, and it's a film that I haven't seen again. I think I'm going to enjoy it a second time. So I thought they did a good job there. I also like them. Do you guys see Hole in the Ground?
Yeah. That one made a lot of lists. Yeah. I was not as fond of that one.
Yeah, I liked that one.
But yeah. It was still a decent viewing.
Yeah.
There was one that I watched this year, and I'm trying. Rotten Tomatoes is telling me that it came out, and there were a couple of U.S. reviews, but I saw this film called Golden Glove.
I was trying to see it.
Fatih Akin's movie. Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, that's about as close to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer as you can get, except for the German version of it, because it's about a serial killer in Hamburg, Germany, who just fucking – it's just days in the life of this very unpleasant-looking gentleman who brings people home and kills them and stashes them underneath a window in his house until they rot and – It's a Golden Glover refers to the bar that he frequents, but it's just
and he looks Joe Spinelli. They make him look all kind of like
super Joe Spinelli. I mean, that was the thing. It was like, you know, in terms of like my itch for watching incredibly seedy, unpleasant films, this definitely scratched that itch because I was like, I didn't know what I was getting into at first, and then halfway through, there was just all sorts of really gnarly stuff that was going on. I was like, okay, I'm not enjoying this, but I certainly am respecting it because the actor who is underneath all of that makeup is giving one hell of a performance.
Fatty Akin's a great director. I've seen most of his, like, he was a foreign nominated for best film like a year ago.
Another one that was kind of pushing for almost my top 10, which is in the same vein of it's not pleasant, but I really respected the film, was Beelzebuth. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Beelzebuth was definitely.
I thought it was going to be on all your list because you guys are all.
No, it was.
Because it came out. I mean, like.
Six months ago? 5 months ago?
Oh,
I feel like I watched it back in the
summer. Damn you, Letterboxd. I mean, like, I looked at when it was released and it told me it was like a last year movie.
So. No, I think it was Shudder premiere this year.
Yeah, Shudder put it out. I watched it during the summer.
All right. Well, it's okay. It's sitting just outside my list.
I put it, it was like almost a 10. But yeah, that was another one where it's got this brutal opening, absolutely abhorrent setup, but then it gets more interesting in kind of what it does with that setup.
Yeah.
I don't tend to put documentaries on here, but if we were doing like the top 10 horror things of the year, I think horror noir should be very high because I think it's made a lot of us think about the genre. And it just, I don't know, it felt like somebody opened a whole new kind of viewpoint to me. Mm-hmm. And I really liked it. And I think about it quite a lot. And people should check that one out.
I also have to give a little bit of love to Escape Room because I had a blast seeing
it. That's like Crawl. Like, I actually might have even liked it more in a way. Like, Escape Room was really fun. I forgot all about it.
The ending. It kind of lost me at the end, but the whole time watching it, I was just like, this is so fun. Yeah. I was having such a blast seeing how they were figuring out the rooms.
I enjoyed it more than Saw movies, to be honest. Like, yeah. It was just more that speed because it's more about being clever.
Yeah, it was clever. And I will also say, on television-wise, when I was thinking about including television, but then I figured we'd all yell at each other if we had done that, Los Espookies.
Oh, yeah.
By far one of my favorite shows.
Los Espookies.
I love it. Yeah. It's like somebody made a show about horror fans that don't know what to do. They have no outlet, so this is what happens. And it's a fun show. Yeah,
I'm going to ask you anyway, favorite Blu-ray that you were like happy came with Blu-ray?
I just want to mention a movie that we lost. Tone Deaf. A Ricky Bates movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which came out this year.
For some reason, I don't think it's hard in my brain.
Notable mention, but nobody's making movies like him.
Yeah.
And when you look at the four, and now he just finished the fifth one or whatever, I think Barbara Crampton's in the new one, and I heard a little bit about it. He's actually talked to us about it on the show, and it sounded insane. I wanted to at least draw attention that Tone Deaf is out there, and Ricky Bates is still making movies unlike anyone else.
And I do have to say that one of my favorite theatrical events of this year was seeing Fingers in the theater. Because I had no fucking clue where that was going, and it was just a wild trip.
hopefully released next year. Mm-hmm. I hope it's getting good.
I'm going to be putting it on my other top 10. That's all I'm going to say.
Fingers is going on your other one?
Yeah, so I'll just drop that there.
Anyway, I had a blast watching that movie.
Yeah, that's one of the most fun films I've seen at theater this year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just curious, before we wrap, if you guys had a favorite, just because we spend so much of our time on the show talking about, like, oh, Vinegar Syndrome dropped this and Scream Factory. I'm just curious if there's one that you're, like, super psyched about, that you're happy. I mean, I'm very happy to know that I'm about to receive Candy Snatchers because I never thought that would happen.
God, that took forever.
I mean, I've been told pretty unequivocally that we would never see that because of rights, and the fact that they've cleared that up, so it's coming my way now. I'm very happy about
have
that.
Have they?
And, well, yes, that's a good point. And Spookies.
We'll see how that goes.
Spookies, which I bought.
I'm getting both. So we
sight unseen. I've never seen Spookies.
Well, while you guys are researching, I'll tell you the one that I was
looking over my letterbox.
For me, it was, and I know you weren't a big fan of this one in terms of film, but Rob Nisser, but Lucio Fulci's The Psychic is my favorite release.
Yeah.
And I loved seeing the film again, and it reminded me how, like, it's as close as you'll ever get to Hitchcock. you know, it's pretty classy for Fulci. It's a really good twist, but the extra features on that, the interview with the writer who worked with Fulci and had some pretty explosive conversations. He also worked with Sergio Leone. It's just like next level interview. It's just so good. All the stories. I was like having to grab still frames because every quote was incredible about the writing process. And this is a really good one. And I heard later that I guess Tarantino was a big fan and was going to incorporate the twist of this movie, which is just the idea that she has this thing that makes musical sound. Mm-hmm. He was going to at some point either remake this like a long time ago back in the kind of Kill Bill or take that kind of thing as a twist device. I don't know where I read it, but I was like, that's fascinating that he would watch Fulci's The Psychic and have that idea. But yeah, I like that release a lot. I mean, Night Beast. I'm so happy so many of these crazy movies that we love dropped this year. It feels like every month there was something that I had dreamed of coming to disc.
Yeah, I'm pretty – I mean, like I'll tell you right now. I mean, Uninvited is
oh, that's right. I still have to see that
is
one.
Is that the cat one?
About the cat within the cat that comes out and eats people on the boat.
The cat and the cat.
It is – positively one of the strangest movies that evaded me growing up, and then I forgot. Oh shit! It was Severin that put it out. I think
which one? That one.
Uninvited.
Was
the Uncanny. Oh yeah.
Not the Uncanny. That's
different. Yeah.
Yeah. The Cushing movie. Yeah.
That's Vinegar Syndrome.
Vinegar Syndrome. Yeah. Vinegar Syndrome.
Doesn't it have a cat as well?
Thank you. No. Uncanny does have a cat. Yeah. It's an anthology.
Yeah.
Uninvited is the one about the party kids who stow away on a boat with some pretty bad dudes. But what they don't know is that this cat has also stowed away on their ship, and the cat has something residing within it that tends to come out and kill people. I'm very pleased.
I'm looking back over my letterbox to figure out what Blu-rays I watched this year that I was kind of excited about. And I have to say, I loved Murder Rock.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I'd actually seen it before, but I hadn't seen it in a long time. So that was like a really fun one.
All right. But I just want to go back. All right. So really quick, this is a question I have for you. What was the first film you logged this year on your letterbox?
Good question. You go to your diary.
You go to your year.
Bird Box, January 3rd.
Diary? And how do you feel about it?
I gave it 3.5 stars.
Mine was Nightmare Beach.
Nice.
Nightmare Beach was first one horror? I saw pretty
now,
early, too.
My second one was...
first movie in general.
My second one was The Terror from 1978.
Yeah.
Or just Terror. Not The Terror. This just take a while.
Kicked off the...
Bandersnatch was this year. It's listed as 2018, but Bandersnatch I watched on January 8th, and I really liked that. I had a good time watching it.
Starman was my first.
Starman
movie.
Was your first?
January 1st of this year.
Nice, very nice.
And then I quickly binged all of the stuff about the Fire Island or the Fire Fest fraud. I see them both come up right after that.
Another film, and this is looking at the letterbox, just reminded me too that I think that Piercing.
Yep, I got that here too.
That was my nice shout out.
Second movie of the year.
Yeah.
Piercing should get a nice little shout out. Nick Pesce did a fantastic job.
All that Italian music that he reused in it.
And also the models.
That is my
the
first
cityscape
film
models.
Of January.
Is it?
It's Piercing.
And because this is spoiling future list, but it's going to be quite high on my Pure Cinema list because I just didn't really, my brain really, even though he was on the show, I'd never thought of his horror. I was still, even when I watched that, Giallo had vibes.
It's a horror, but
I think it's a really cool little movie.
But Elric, you know what we should give at least a shout out to is I see in April that we watched watched The Dead Center together.
Yeah, that was on, that was my number nine for a long time, and I've seen it twice.
That just
at two
came
theaters.
Out through Arrow. Yeah,
I think people who are into dark horror, like dark serious horror films, should probably check it out.
Yeah, it was pretty cool,
and it kind of has Wounds-ish moments.
Yes,
with this kind of, you know, alternate.
It doesn't push it quite as far.
Dead Center. The Dead Center. It's like Shane Carruth.
No, I did not. Okay. I remember
it's very Wounds-ish. Yes. It does not push it as far, but it's got some cool stuff to
it. Yeah, I feel like if Wounds and that merged, it would be the great.
How did I see that?
We saw it at two film festivals. We saw it twice because I had a Q&A.
Texas
and Chattanooga.
Oh, that was it. Okay, yeah, Chattanooga.
But it's a good movie, and it's on the festival circuit. And
For me, really quick, there's been some great box sets coming out. I know Ryan already talked about The Omen. Mm-hmm. I just got their Fly collection from Scream Factory,
so
and it is absolutely fantastic. I mean, the movies are already great as it is. It is worth it for the brand new interview with Mel Brooks.
I can't wait.
It's like 15, 20 minutes with him on. And actually, it's not a spoiler, but it's got a great bit where, like, he does his interview. He's great, talking about the history, the credits roll. And then, like, there's a little post-credit scene where he's like, do you guys pay me to do this or do I just have to do it for free? Kind of like, in a very Mel Brooks kind of way.
That's fun.
That's fantastic. I've only just begun, but the Criterion Godzilla set is kind of an amazing thing to exist.
What the fuck does the packaging look like that?
It's
like it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Everybody's like, look at my Once Upon a Time in Hollywood Blu-ray, and the packaging is all wonky. So how the fuck is
packaging
that?
Is there to for the OCD in me and my shelves. It is it is a problem, Ryan.
Come on.
I agree with you.
Just stick with the regular. Jesus Christ.
And what else came out?
That's an old man Turk rant.
Yeah. just stuff.
I need physical media that I can display.
He's not wrong.
I also don't use my physical media as furniture. I sock it away. I hide it.
Yeah, you have drawers. Yeah, I've considered going to the drawers.
Can't. Well, guys, that was a great 2019 chat.
It's been a good year. What a cool twist today.
I know. Lots of twists and turns. Listeners, thank you. Thank you for sticking with us through this episode. New listeners, we try to remind people that we are on iTunes. Rate and review us. It goes a long way in spreading the word about Shockwaves. Even if it's negative, totally get it, whatever. But we love positive feedback.
You prefer positive.
But activity is activity, so.
Exactly. But anyways, if you're a new listener, we hope you stick with us. Come back next week when we dive into the best of the decade.
We're going to get down crazy. Our top 150.
No.
Dead Don't Die. All 10 of my spots.
10 in this
I've
decade.
Got them. I'm ready.
All right. Well, it's a hefty task. I know I've got homework to do.
I do.
So I think we should sign off.
All right. See you next week. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
night, guys.
Bye. Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Sanye, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pacetta, and Rob Galuzzo.